Good Friday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. I have a fantastic program for you. Mr. Ed Morrissey of Hot Air is going to be with us a little bit later on in the hour. He's got his brand new book coming out, Going Red. We'll talk about the GOP debate last night, some of the other big stories of the week. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms on some of the big Second Amendment stories coming up later on in the hour as well. Next hour, Amy Hunter, NRA ILA Media Liaison. A couple of things to talk with Amy about. Permitless carry and the legislative override of the governor's veto in West Virginia. Also, you've got hearings in Maryland, a lot of anti-gun bills up for debate, but also campus carry up for discussion in Maryland. Daniel Gelertner from, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Cameron, DITAC. Is that correct?
I'll double check.
I've never heard this website before.
I think it's DITACH. It's an app that...
DITACH.
That collates web attachments.
Ah, okay. There you go. See, all of these word combos, and sometimes my brain just doesn't even recognize the two of them. DITACH. All right. So he's got a piece at National Review. Liberals want your car keys. And it's interesting, Daniel makes this analogy to smart guns. In his piece about driverless cars, turns out Daniel's actually an NRA instructor, so maybe that's why the comparison came to him. It's a fascinating piece, so we'll talk with Daniel next hour. Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show in Baltimore, Maryland, on the Democratic senator there in the state, who says, we're not going to stop our push for gun control laws until the death toll reaches zero. The problem is that, after the Maryland Fire and Safety Act went into effect, the death toll in Baltimore started climbing to a 20-year high in 2015. So they're going to keep pushing, it sounds like, in the wrong direction for a long, long time. We'll talk again with Derek about it in hour three. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News in Indianapolis, Indiana. We've got the hero of the day, our deal of the day, excuse me, our good guy of the day. By Monday, I think the CPAC plague should finally be gone. It started, I swear, and I know I got it from CPAC because it's all on the right side of my head. Started up here, has gradually worked its way down. Now it seems to be lodged in my throat. So I apologize. There is a new study out, quote-unquote study, and it is getting, I think, quite a bit of play, and it's probably going to get quite a bit of play over the weekend. Here's how the Christian Science Monitor's Jason Thompson reports it. Federal gun control laws could reduce deaths up to 90%, study says. Yeah. If we only passed a couple of gun control laws at the federal level, we could reduce deaths up to 90% in this country, which is amazing because accidents, homicides, suicides involving firearms don't account for nearly 90% of the deaths in this country. Oh, the sub-headline says gun-related deaths if we were to pass these three gun control laws. In every one of these stories that I've seen leads with this claim. The research published Thursday in The Lancet, British Medical Journal, considered 25 different gun laws across all 50 states during the year 2009 and compared them with data on gun deaths compiled by U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Lead author Bindu Kalasen from Boston University said, we wanted to investigate what several studies have already indicated. Restrictive gun laws can reduce gun deaths. And then we wanted to investigate what might happen if we could implement one or two laws federally. Is there one that would work across all states? And so they, let's see. Christian Science Monitor says what the study found was of the 25 laws under consideration, 9 were effective at reducing gun deaths, and the rest were either ineffective or inconclusive. They say stand your ground laws in particular were associated with a 7% increase in gun deaths. On the other hand, they say 3 laws stood out for their ability to reduce gun-related deaths. Background checks for purchasing firearms. Background checks for purchasing ammunition. And something called firearm identification. I don't even know what that would be. Using predictive models, the Christian Science Monitor says, The researchers then looked at what effect federal implementation of each of these laws, or all of them together, might have on gun deaths nationally. And they found that any one of them would result in a marked decrease of such incidents using their predictive models. Co-author Jeffrey Fagan of Columbia University said, "We're not claiming that these reductions would occur overnight or even within a year. But after a longer period of sustained and intensive efforts to implement the three measures that we cite, we would begin to see significant reductions in gun deaths in places that take implementation seriously." So it wouldn't happen overnight. But after a longer period of sustained and intensive efforts to implement the three measures that we cite, we would begin to see significant reductions in gun deaths in places that take implementation seriously. We're going to come back to that. So finally, when you get down, this is again the Christian Science Monitor, you get down to paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Paragraph 12. "While many observers agree the study marks an important first step in providing solid scientific data, there is some skepticism about the depths of the claims." Oh, really? David Hemingway of the Harvard School of Public Health, the guy who's not seen as a pro-gun researcher by any stretch of the imagination, says that while the researchers did try to control for some variables, quote, "many other important factors were not controlled for, e.g. poverty, alcohol consumption, urbanicity, mental health." James Allen Fox of Northeastern University says, yeah, he says unemployment is an important variable to control for, which the study did. So is the percentage of the population belonging to minorities, which it did not. The claim that these laws could reduce gun deaths by as much as 90% also procures disbelief from both commentators, with Fox calling it, quote, "overambitious" and stretching his, quote, "thought of credibility." Huh. So it sounds like, yeah, there is some criticism here of this study that purports if we just pass a few federal laws there, universal background checks on every sale of ammunition, something called firearms identification, 90% drop in gun-related fatalities. But the co-author, Dr. Fagan, the lead author, Dr. Callisan, says what this research shows is that President Obama was right when he, quote, "tried really hard but failed to implement comprehensive background checks." So that's what the study shows. It shows President Obama was right, according to the study's authors. Oh. So this wouldn't be like an attempt to politicize science or anything, right? Research? Callisan says, "This is the first definitive step towards providing sound policies." By making wildly exaggerated claims? We need to inform the public, he says. Nobody's trying to take the guns away. But just introducing background checks could help reduce injuries and deaths around the country. So let's go back to what the Christian Science Monitor reported a little bit, or quoted earlier in the story. Jeffrey Fagan, co-author there at Columbia University. So these reductions wouldn't happen overnight, wouldn't happen within a year. Some undefined period of time would go by after these gun control laws were implemented. And then you would start to see reductions in gun deaths in places that take implementation seriously. And perhaps not in those places that did not take the implementation of that seriously. So there'd be local variables. In other words, not so different from what we have today, where we have federal gun laws, we also have state gun laws. So what actually happened? Seems to me like, they looked at 25 different laws and 25 different across all 50 states during 1 year, 2009. What actually happened in the one locale in the United States that implemented, in essence, even more restrictive policies? It wasn't about background checks for firearms or ammunition. It was you couldn't own a gun. there. How about that? And we'll enforce this to the best of our ability. We're serious about this. What happened in that jurisdiction when they actually did this in the District of Columbia? Because they did this in 1976. The law took effect in 1977. What happened? 1977, the violent crime rate was 1,426 violent crimes per 100,000 people in the District of Columbia. The homicide rate was 27.8. Well, you wouldn't want to wait just a year, right? Because, again, this is supposed to take time. Let's go 5 years. 1982. Violent crime in the district had grown. 2,123 violent crimes per 100,000 people, up from 1,426.5. Homicide rate in 1982 had grown from 27.8 to 30.7. Rapes had gone up from 58.3 to 66.7. Robberies had increased from 964.5 to 1,448 per 100,000 people. Aggravated assaults had gone up from 375.9 to 577 per 100,000 people. Maybe it took a little bit more time for these laws to really have an impact. What if we went 10 years out and looked at crime stats 1977, 1987? You had 10 years of this gun-free D.C. policy. Violent crime down a little bit, but still above 1977 levels, 1,610 violent crimes per 100,000 people. Homicide rate was up even higher from 27.8 to 36.2. Rapes had decreased, that's a good thing, from 58.3 down to 39.4. And then you look at the 1990s, and violent crime rate starts going up again. Homicide rate, again, reaches a high of 80 per 100,000 people in the District of Columbia in 1991, 15 years after the gun ban had gone into effect. It strikes me as, you know, again, it's kind of a bold claim to say that these three laws, if put into effect, would have such a dramatic decrease on gun-related deaths in this country, considering, again, similar provisions to keep guns out of the hands of citizens, good and bad, met with such an abysmal failure in Washington, D.C. But, again, I don't think that this was necessarily, it sounds to me like, you know, if the point of this research was to promote gun control policies, and the conclusion was, well, President Obama was right, and we got to have more of these studies that show that President Obama is right. Again, maybe this is maybe the figure of 90% is supposed to grab attention, create those headlines, and the criticisms and the critiques of this study can get buried on paragraph 12. And so if you click the head, you don't even read the story. If you just look at the headline, well, my goodness gracious, you've got an extraordinary headline. Not really buttressed by reality, but you've got an extraordinary headline. The researchers don't say, you know, one of the laws that they said that should be put in place here was the background checks for ammunition purchases. I'm not aware of any state law right now requiring background checks for ammunition purchases. I know that the New York Safe Act requires background checks for all purchases of ammunition, but that law has not gone into effect because the state police there in New York haven't figured out how to do this. California, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is also calling for a similar measure. That'll be on the ballot, but again, it's unclear how this would actually work. I suppose the researcher would say, well, if we're talking about a federal law, then it would simply involve utilizing the NICS system for every ammo purchase, which, you know, wouldn't bog down the NIC system at all or anything, right? And again, $25 every time you want to purchase a box of ammunition. It's interesting. I mean, they say that if these policies were put into effect and fully enforced over a long period of time, a period of sustained and intensive efforts to implement the three measures that they cite, according to their predictive models, they would begin to see significant reductions in places that take implementation seriously. It just seems to me that, again, in those cities and locales where you have seen sustained and intensive efforts to implement gun control measures, we haven't seen anywhere close to significant reductions in violent crime, in firearm-related deaths. Even in those places that take implementation seriously. But again, maybe the research is not as important as the headline here. We got to take a quick time out. When we come back, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air will join us. We'll talk about last night's GOP debate, talk about some of the other big stories of the week. Stick around. We'll be right back with more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Philip Hosnoot with Salted Earth. Philip, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
All right. So tell us, what is Salted Earth? What do you guys do?
So Salted Earth is a technology startup. We're based out of Arizona right now. Been in business about a year, focused primarily on dry fire training, bringing targets to market to help people train anywhere and in any environment.
So when you say technology startup, what kind of stuff? You've got a product here you're going to show us. Is it mainly oriented towards the firearms industry, or is it all sorts of stuff?
We're basically exclusively in the firearm industry right now.
Okay. And what is it that you do? What kind of product?
So this is the first product that we're launching in a lineup. It's part of the Atlas series, which stands for Adaptive Training Laser System. It's a whole system of targets.
Wait, so we get to see the first product you're doing?
This is the first product that we're launching, debuted here at the SHOT Show. It's a reactive dry fire laser training target. It's the kind of the one of the many sizes we'll be coming out with. Has an 8x8 array of LEDs, and it allows you to basically simulate most of the types of trainings you normally do at the live fire range.
So how does that work?
So we have it works with any red, green, or infrared laser. This is a next-level training training pistol. It'll work with anything, including Crimson Trace. Works with flashlights as well. So you can basically configure it through our mobile app to run any standardized training that you normally would.
Very cool. So it gives you an opportunity, a way to train without having to actually be on the range.
Right, exactly.
Very safe, very portable, very anything. So it's the company's called Salted Earth. What's that product?
That's the Atlas 8.
The Atlas 8, and so does it come sort of together as a kit, or is that just a separate part of it?
Right now it's a separate part. We're looking at potential partnerships down the road.
How can you get more information about your company and about the Atlas 8?
You can go to thesaltedearth.com. We have a lot of information up there, a lot of videos of it in action, how to use it, that kind of thing.
Phil with Salted Earth, thank you for this great new product. Thanks for showing it here on NRA News, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Talk with a friend, Benny Spies, again from Gunner with Benny Spies. Hopefully the audience has watched the program. If not,
if you have it, you should.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a fun show, and that's what I like about it, is that it's not your... It's not, you know, 2 minutes in.
No, we do a lot.
We've got to, you know, when's the dead deer coming? As you say, it really is personality driven.
Yep.
You are, you're quite the personality.
There's a lot of moving parts. We do a lot of different things. We drive around that old Winnebago, the Toaster 73, or the old Chevelle 65. It's a secret weapon. You know, we got the new boat, the Aluma Craft, the Willie Nelson. You know, there's a lot of moving parts, and we have a lot of fun.
Why is the boat called the Willie Nelson?
Because my old man, when I was a kid, take me fishing or whatever, wherever we were going, hunting or fishing, he had one tape, and it was stuck into the cassette tape in the pickup, and it was always On the Road Again. It's the only song that I ever, my first favorite song, so I dedicated the boat to Willie Nelson.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Does
story.
The Chevelle have a name?
The Chevelle's a secret weapon, yeah.
It's just the secret weapon.
That's not running right now. Nothing of mine runs.
No?
No, the boat does, but nothing of mine runs.
Do you actually, like, tow the toaster?
Yeah, the toaster would be better off on fire.
But it's iconic.
It is iconic.
You'll never be able to get rid of that thing.
I hope I don't have to. So I hope I can keep doing this. And where I go, the toaster goes.
Right.
That's maybe, that's the plan.
So you're saying that you don't want to show up here 1 year and be like, instead of the toaster, you've got the bread oven, which is like the, you know, the 80-foot long concert tour bus.
Well, that means we've upgraded a little bit.
Yeah.
But I still want it to be in the 70s. You know, we need the shag carpet. You know, we need it. Smelling like the 70s. There's more mice living in that thing right now. That I have a trap line actually set up in there, and I put a big jar of peanut butter at the end of it. I say, if you guys can make it through that, Godspeed.
To NRA News, Cam and Company. Jim Jakes of Bearing Arms coming up a little bit later on in the hour. I just realized this is a Salem Media Power Hour right here. We've got Jim Jakes of Bearing Arms coming up in just a little bit right now from Hot Air. Ed Morrissey joins us. How you doing, Ed?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me on.
It is. It's my pleasure. All right, so I did my homework last night. First GOP debate in maybe the last three or four that I actually watched. I have to say it was substantive, which is one of the reasons why I'd kind of stopped watching, because it just felt more like a circus sideshow and entertainment. This was a honest-to-goodness debate last night.
It was, yeah. It was actually a substantive debate. I have to give kudos. In full disclosure here, Salem Media Group, which Hot Air is a subsidiary, was CNN's broadcast partner here. But, you know, CNN decided to do something different. Jake Tapper decided to do something different. In almost every other debate, in fact, I think in every other debate, the first segment of the debate has kind of gone to the, you know, the process questions. The, you know, so-and-so said this about you. What do you have to say about that? No, well, what do you have to say about what he just said about you? And that sort of thing. And Jake Tapper spent that whole first segment talking about trade and immigration and sticking to particular policies and particular issues without mentioning other people. And I think that the Republican candidates had a very easy time focusing on their own approaches to these things. Later on in the debate, of course, there was a little bit more of that sort of mix, you know, where somebody said something, you got a response back. But that whole first segment, I don't think anybody demanded, you know, a response time to what somebody else had said. Or if it was just simply on clarifying a policy statement. And it made for a much more watchable political debate. Now, maybe not as entertaining, you know, because the circus didn't come to town, but it was certainly a much better political debate. And I think it put the Republican candidates that were on stage in a much better light than they had been in the last couple of debates. And so I think the big winner was probably the RNC, but kudos to CNN and Jake Tapper in particular for sort of taking control of that debate early on in the first segment and setting the tone that really I think all four of the candidates wanted to follow anyway.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I would say kudos as well to the other questioners, including Hugh Hewitt from Salem Media, who I think has done a fantastic job on the a couple of occasions that he had a chance to be a part of these debates. You know, again, I think a lot of the, as you say, a lot of the tone is set by the moderator. Certainly the candidates bring their own, you know, game plan to each and every debate. But it's also, and I think it's also easier when you only have, you know, four candidates up there on stage as opposed to 12 or 13, and everybody's jockeying for position. Everybody's keeping track of how many questions they've been asked and things of that nature.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. Even with that approach in mind, I don't think you would have had nearly the same kind of debate with eight people on stage or even six people on stage. I think the four people that were on stage was about the right number. I think that everybody had adequate time to answer questions that were given to them. They kind of ignored the game show bell, the ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
They almost all of them would talk over that.
Drives my wife crazy. She notices every time. She says, you need to stop talking. And I said, well, they want to get their point across.
Again, it's not a game show, right?
Right.
I mean, those guys are up there, they're running for president. If they have, you know, they're basically using it as a guideline that, okay, I really do have to wrap it up at this point. I presume, and I think this is true in every debate, that they have a timer that's in front of them that they can see, where they can look down and see how many seconds they have left. And that's the reason why they're pretty much close to finishing up when that bell goes off anyway. But, you know, they're trying to get a little extra time. They're trying to, you know, get a little extra edge on everybody else. So But you didn't have anybody really abusing that. What you didn't have is you didn't have people yelling over each other and talking about personal issues, about, you know, somebody's height or somebody's, you know, finger size or whatever. And as entertaining as those things are, they're not very enlightening when it comes to actual policy issues. And the one thing that I took from this is that you had three people on stage who were very well read on policy issues. And you had one person on stage who, with a couple of policy area exceptions, trade being a significant exception, simply isn't. And that's Donald Trump. He's very good on the trade part of it, though, and that came first. So it really helped him look a little bit more statesmanlike.
Yeah, no, I would largely agree. And I think probably the worst moment for him was on Cuba, which was probably Rubio's best moment, in the debate last night. You know, it's interesting. I don't think anybody had a wretched night. Although, if anything, I think John Kasich was sort of the forgotten man, at that debate. I honestly can't think of like a line that he said that really brought the crowd to its feet or really resonated. But I don't think anybody had a particularly horrible evening last night.
No, actually, I agree with you on that. And the reason why Kasich sort of disappeared in this debate, I mean, he had plenty of speaking time, was because the reason why he stood out the last time is because he was the only one that wasn't really participating in the circus. He was ignoring what was going on with the other three candidates. And he really kind of had his own debate with the moderators. And so it stood out, sort of like, you know, the adult in the room, as people, put it later on. Well, your no-nonsense approach is great when there's a lot of nonsense on stage to contrast it with. But when there isn't any nonsense going on stage, the contrast disappears. And I think you got, you know, sort of what John Kasich is. You know, he's a solid guy. He's crossed up the conservative movement once or twice, so there's some hostility there towards Kasich, but he's a solid guy. He's got a solid record as governor, and he does well in a state that Republicans absolutely have to win. But other than that, I'm not sure that there's a, you know, there isn't a Kasich movement. There isn't a Kasich groundswell. You don't see a populist or, well, populist is wrong. You don't see a grassroots impulse for a Kasich nomination. He's making it based on experience, which in this cycle is really almost the opposite argument of what's going to prevail. And he just doesn't, you know, produce much excitement. Even when he's just talking about policy, he's a good solid guy, but I just don't see him getting much traction outside of Ohio.
Well, and that was going to be my next question here is, you know, we are coming down to a couple of key dates here, March 15th being the first one. Do you think that 2 weeks from now, Ed, are we going to have a much more solid idea of what's going to happen in the GOP nomination race the rest of the way? Or is there still that chance that 2 weeks from now, everything's going to be just as much up in the air as it is right now?
Well, yeah, I think there's a chance for both. I mean, if Kasich wins Ohio and if Rubio wins Florida, and there's some polling in the last 24 hours that shows that both of these guys are starting to get some traction. Then I think, yeah, you got a four-way race probably all the way down to the end because nobody's going to have a real incentive to drop out at that point. And they'll go as long as their money holds up. But if Trump wins Florida, I think Rubio's done. And if Trump wins Ohio, I think Kasich's done. I don't think Cruz is done. So what you might end up with is either a four-man race, or a three-man race, or a two-man race after March 15th. But March 15th is really going to be the big, inflection point, I think, because I think if you have the votes split up that way, and of course you also got Missouri, where Cruz is within single digits of Trump now, and that's also, I believe, on Tuesday, as well as North Carolina, which is a proportionally allocated state, then I think that you've got a real problem for Trump in that invincibility argument. He's still going to be in the lead. He's still going to have the better arc to the nomination. But then that opens up a much more plausible arc to nobody getting 1,237 delegates before the convention and forcing a contested convention in July.
All right, so how concerned – I've got to ask you this. How concerned are you about the movement being able to come back together at some point before November?
Are you talking about the conservative movement or are you talking about the Republican Party?
more the movement. Certainly, okay. You know, I guess maybe the better question might be the party. But, you know, you're seeing these fractures develop in the conservative movement as well.
I don't think you're seeing fractures in the intellectual conservative movement. I mean, this is the National Review, Heritage Foundation, Club for Growth, you know, the sort of the pillars of, you know, intellectual and philosophical conservatism. I don't know that you're going to see that fracture all that much. I think what's going to happen is they're going to feel more and more sidelined, though. And I think what you're seeing is a Republican Party is sort of a stampede towards a populist, protectionist economic model. That's really what Trump is pushing. And you saw last night all four candidates expressed reservations about free trade agreements. And that's pretty unusual for a Republican presidential debate. I mean, usually we're saying free trade because free trade's open markets for American, you know, American companies and American capital, and we bring capital into the United States that way, and it all trickles down. Well, people just aren't buying that anymore, in large part because of the Great Recession and the aftermath of it, with really poor recovery that we've had ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they've been listening to these free trade arguments for really ever since NAFTA, and it's simply not working. And that's the reason why Bernie Sanders ended up winning in Michigan too, is that Hillary Clinton is associated with free trade sort of consensus, the political consensus in Washington, D.C., which, you know, goes across both parties, right? Republicans and Democrats have pushed forward free trade agreements, including the TPP that's coming up from Barack Obama. And people just aren't buying that there's enough protection in it to protect American jobs and protect American workers. And so this is sort of the reaction to that. And I think Trump and Sanders are really fronting that. And I think it's a big problem for the conservative movement within the Republican Party, because I think that for the first time since Reagan, it's going to take a back seat in the GOP. Political, you know, conservatism, I should say.
You know, and it's interesting. There was a book that came out, I think it was last year, and I realized that we should be talking more about your book, which is coming out soon, Going Red. But there was this book called Factory Man, and it was written by Beth Macy, who's a reporter here in Virginia. And it followed the one of the guys in the Bassett furniture family. And he was sort of the last guy who was making furniture under the Bassett name here in America. And it explored how China had taken over the furniture manufacturing industry and followed all of these jobs disappearing from Southwest Virginia, from northern North Carolina, that whole area that used to employ thousands of people making furniture. And slowly China took over more and more of this business. And finally, this guy who runs his own furniture company notices that there was a bedroom set that he manufactured that was for sale by a Chinese company for less than it cost for him to make this bedroom set. And he thought, okay, what's going on here? And so the book kind of follows this guy as he, really starts exploring the Chinese furniture industry. And what you find is that the Chinese government is subsidizing a lot of these companies to operate at losses. In many cases, what we think we are engaging in free trade, but our trading partners can very well be engaging in economic warfare. And when you read, you know, again, the best of intentions for these companies wanting to, again, you know, open up markets, but the end result being that American jobs are lost and authoritarian, totalitarian state is fine subsidizing these losses because ultimately it's better for them, or they believe it's better for them. All of a sudden you realize this is a heck of a lot more complex subject than free trade good, fair trade, and closed borders bad. I mean, there's trading partners, and we're not able to decide what our trading partners are going to do. They've got their own agenda.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the reason why when you negotiate these agreements, you have to make sure that you follow through and that you've got good verification on them. And that's what Trump is saying, is that the agreements are poorly drafted, and the people who are responsible for keeping an eye on how they're implemented are, he calls them babies, but basically incompetent. And that's an argument that's going to resonate. And again, I think, I don't think you're going to have a splintering of intellectual conservatism, because it's got a pretty firm basis. You know, you got Edmund Burke, you've got, F.A. Hayek, you've got Milton Friedman. There's a philosophical and intellectual basis for, especially fiscal conservatism. And I don't think that social conservatism is going to change a whole lot either. I think the social conservatives will hang together pretty well. I think what you're seeing, though, is that those groups are going to be eclipsed by more of a focus on blue-collar economics that are driven by protectionism. It's sort of the Pat Buchanan wing of the Republican Party is becoming much more ascendant, I think, with Donald Trump. And there's a reason why Pat Buchanan has been talking up Donald Trump is because that was kind of what Pat Buchanan was arguing 24 years ago.
Talking again with Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Unfortunately, Ed, we are out of time here. When does Going Red come out? When does it hit the shelves?
Going Red comes out on April 12th. You can find out more at goingredbook.com. I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling, so keep an eye out on the goingredbook.com site because all the events will be posted there. I'll be coming through Virginia and Washington, D.C., Cam, so I'm hoping we can get together when they do.
Absolutely. I will let me know what date you'll be there, and I will drive up for that.
That sounds great. Thanks.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Ed Morrissey joins from Hot Air here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms continuing the unofficial. We didn't plan it this way. It just sort of turned out. The Salem Media Power Hour. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms later in the program. Amy Hunter, NRA ILA Media Liaison, join us next hour. We're going to talk permitless carry in West Virginia. Going to talk some anti-gun bills as well as a pro-gun measure in Maryland. Turnout, by the way, in Annapolis, I was pleased to see. We had pro-gun voices out there. We did have some anti-gun voices out there, the state capitol as well. But gun owners, 3 years after the passage of the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, they have not given up on their rights in their state. They are still fighting for the right to keep and bear arms. We'll talk with Daniel Glertner of Detach.com as well, writing a piece in National Review. Liberals want your car keys, along with a lot of other things. And he does absolutely make the correlation between driverless cars and smart guns, which, after Daniel explained it, made a heck of a lot of sense to me. So stick around. We've got much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV. Jana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So I follow you on social media, and I always see, you're out. Geez, you're everywhere. So I'm glad you had a chance to sit down and talk to us for a minute. But you use Nosler ammunition, and Nosler is our primary underwriting sponsor for NRA News Cam and Company. So I've been dying to get to sit down with you to talk a little bit about that. So tell us, how did you form this relationship with Nosler using their stuff?
Absolutely. Well, Jim Kinsey, my boyfriend and executive producer of Skullbound TV, he had a relationship with Nosler, a previous relationship. He introduced me. I'm from the Midwest, from Wisconsin.
I couldn't tell by the accent.
I know. You betcha. He introduced me to Nosler about 6 years ago, and that is literally the only ammunition I have used. For all six seasons of Skullbound TV, we're filming right now for season six, and it's just so incredibly accurate and dependable. I did a really neat episode this year. You know, Nosler was founded on one of their moose hunts gone bad years ago, the ammunition, not on Nosler ammunition, but, they founded the ammunition company because they needed something more reliable after this bad encounter with a moose hunt. And I ended up drawing an incredible moose tag, went into Alaska, do it yourself, rented the horses, packed in, ended up just being blessed with a 64-inch bull moose.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, those Nosler bullets did the trick.
And I'll tell you what, Janet, whether you're shooting, hunting like you do, shooting competitively, this is probably, if not outside the firearm, the most important thing to be a successful shooter.
It really is. I mean, a lot of things can go wrong, but it's so nice when you realize that, especially like with a moose or an elk, they're such big animals. You need your ammunition to perform beautifully. And I got into long-range shooting about 3 years ago. I've trained with some of the best sniper champions, world champions. They all use Nosler as well. And
wow.
It just, when you can take out, a lot of things can grow on you. And, of course, you need to plug in all your ballistics, and you've got wind and altitude and all these things. But when you have ammo that you can count on to perform the way it's supposed to, and, you know, when it says it's, you know, their ballistics are what they say it is, it's just a beautiful thing.
It takes out one of those nagging variables, whether the weather and the, you know, that's so great. Speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV about Nozzler. So let's shift gear a little bit and talk a little bit about what's going on with Skullbound. How long have you been doing the show?
We are airing season 5 right now. It's amazing. Cool. I'm so blessed.
So going from when you started to now, did you ever think that this would be happening?
I really didn't. I did not. I didn't foresee the success that it would have, and we just feel so blessed that things have come together the way they have. Our hunts have gone well. I feel even more lucky to have the platform for my personal conservation causes, because conservation is a very passionate topic to me. We always include a conservation piece on every episode, but it's also given me the platform to start taking veterans out hunting, and it's been seriously some of the most fulfilling moments of my life. I took another Army veteran double amputee out this year on his first elk hunt, and he got his bull on day 2, and there were tears all around. And I have to say, when I told Nozzler that I was taking another Army hero out, they built him the gun. They gave him the ammo. You know, they have been such a tremendous supporter of Skullbound TV and our veterans. And it just is one more reason I'm so proud to be partnered with them.
And it's something I've been following, too. We've had you on before with Cam a number of times talking about that. I follow on the social media. It's so great that you do that. And isn't it great to have it's a great agenda to have to begin with, you ask me, but to have a vehicle like this, you know, some of us are very lucky and blessed that we get to do what we do.
Right.
And to me, you're doing such great work. So
it's a way to say thank you. And, you know, here I am in a woman in the greatest country in the world. I'm able to pursue my dreams, and I'm able to, you know, have a house full of guns, if you will, because of these men and women. And it's just a way to give back to them. And it's a wonderful platform to have that we don't take lightly.
Jana Waller, how can we get more information about you? Where do we got to go?
You can go to skullboundtv.com. Super simple. We also have a lot of information on the Sportsman's Channel website, but we're on Big Game Wednesday nights. I'm happy to be a part of this industry.
Jana Waller, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzler. Coming to you today from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. Jen Jenks of Bearing Arms is with us on the program. You're going to join us down here soon, aren't you?
Well, I hope to, but I'm kind of sickly. I don't know what's going to happen next week.
I'm kind of sickly, too. I hope that you're feeling better. Is this do you figure it out? Is it your kids who made you sick, or was it CPAC?
That's funny. We went into the emergency room again yesterday for my daughter, Katie, and the doctor took one look at me and said, you're going to be seen. And I have double lung pneumonia. So.
Oh, dear.
Right. I'm like, okay.
Wow.
But props to that ER doctor, because I was not going to be seen. And he's like, I want an EKG. I want chest x-rays. I want a CT scan. And I was giving him a little of a hard time, and I'm saying, you just want to charge me for a CAT scan. I'm fine. This is just a cold. I'm the mom. And sure enough, the CAT scan's what lit it up. It didn't catch it anywhere else. So props to the ER doc for taking one look at me and saying, you sick, lady.
So you had no idea that you were that sick.
Right? Because I'm mom. I just keep going.
Kind of makes me wonder about me now. I'm a little concerned.
Yeah.
I'm feeling better, so unless I start feeling worse, I'm going to stay away.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, well, I hope that you're feeling better soon. I feel awful now. I appreciate you coming on the program feeling as bad as you do.
No problem. I love being here, so this is the bright spot in my day.
Oh, excellent. Well, you know, so yesterday we had this armed citizen story, Jen. I think you covered this at Bearing Arms. Vicksburg, Mississippi, an escaped murderer on the loose, facing the death penalty, ends up taking a family hostage before he is shot and killed, right? Remember that story?
That was pretty amazing. My gosh, that homeowner, what courage, am I right? I mean, the guy came after him and his wife trying to hold them hostage. The wife was hit in the head. Mm-hmm. The husband was stabbed. He finally gets to his gun and shoots the guy dead in a bathtub. So what a great ending. Save the taxpayers some money and, you know, the justice system a little bit of time in dealing with this guy, because he had quite the rap sheet. Wow.
Yeah, he did. And so then today I see this story out of California. A suspect killed by a Torrance, California jewelry store owner was a person of interest in a double homicide in Apple Valley, California.
Exactly. These were two stories back to back, and my gosh, this is literally guns saving lives. I mean, are people paying attention to these stories? Because they are out there and they are amazing. This is everyday citizens. These are ordinary Americans just picking up a gun, defending themselves against violent criminals who should not have been free, number one, and number two, should not have had any type of weapon, whether it's a gun, a knife, a shiv that one of them made in the jail and attacked a guard at the jail. I mean, way to go, America, for standing up, grabbing your gun, and defending yourself. Awesome job.
Absolutely. And, you know, this guy in California, 20-year-old Keon Bailey, believed to be linked to a donut shop robbery there in Apple Valley, a home invasion robbery in Apple Valley, and a double homicide of a 95-year-old man and his 92-year-old wife, Louis Giantini and Rose Giantini, were murdered. Their bodies were discovered on March the 1st. So here's a guy who, again, is believed to be responsible for horrific crimes and a number of crimes over a fairly short period of time. What do you think? California, Jen, supposedly has really, really strong gun control laws, right?
Right. Well, I said Gavin Newsom better grab his smelling salts, because in the last 2 months, California has run over, almost 500,000 background checks for gun sales.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, people are waking up in California. Yeah, they say, oh, you're not supposed to have guns here. Here's a list of handguns you can have here. You know what California is standing up and saying? Uh-uh, I'm buying a gun.
Yep.
Because criminals don't follow the law, and people are getting it. People are seeing stories like these and realizing, hey, we need self-defense. We need an option to protect ourselves. The police are not, able to transport into whatever situation we're going to need defending in. We have to stand up and own our self-defense. We have to own our own security.
Absolutely. Particularly when, you look at this guy. He's 20 years old, Keon Bailey, suspect in this jewelry store robbery that was murdered, that was killed. Released from parole, or released on parole from state prison on February 18th. Jen?
Right, and his previous crimes were burglary, possession of stolen property, rape, grand theft, trespassing, and sexual battery.
He's 20.
My goodness, I'm so glad he was on parole, aren't you, Ken?
He's 20. How much time did he serve for these crimes? We keep hearing that, nonviolent offenders, they're the ones who are being released early in California. How does a 20-year-old have, again, these convictions to his name, and he's out on the streets on parole? How does that happen, Jen?
I honestly have no idea. The only thing I can think of is liberal judges saying, well, they didn't know any better. And now that they've served some time in jail, now they know better. But what's interesting is my husband just started taping a show called 60 Days In, and it follows everyday Americans into jail, and they have to stay there for 60 days. And they're finding all of these things that are going on in jails. A jail does not cure criminals. I'm sorry, but it does not. So what's the answer here? I don't know what it is, but letting them out is not the answer, and keeping them in is not the answer. I don't know what to do.
Actually, who might be really interesting to talk to about this, Dinesh D'Souza has a new book out, and a lot of it is about his time in minimum security. He got to go home on the weekends, but he was there, I think, during the week. Confinement for his illegal campaign contribution. And his latest book talks about this, and it really is fascinating, because he obviously took the most of made the most of that situation that he found himself in, and he talked to a lot of people. The phrase criminal justice reform, I think, means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And you're right. If all we're doing is putting people behind bars, we're warehousing them there, and then as soon as we can possibly let them out, we're letting them out. We should not be surprised at all if our recidivism rate is extraordinarily high, right? You have to do something to try to reach these individuals when they're behind bars so that hopefully they don't end up back behind bars.
And I feel like all they're doing is coming into contact with more violent criminals and learning different things and thinking, man, when I get out, I'm going to do that. I'm going to make more money, and this is how I'm going to, right? I mean, I feel like that's all that's happening.
Yeah, almost like it's finishing school, right?
Oh, my gosh, it's criminal finishing school. Don't make me laugh. I'll start coughing.
Sorry, I know why I had to finish my thoughts so I could have a coughing fit. We're awful right now, Jen. This is like the sick ward. This is horrible.
It is terrible, but it's fun. It's nice to be in good company.
Well, there you go.
I don't know what the answer is. You can't let these people free, and you can't leave them in there forever. So something's got to change, and you're right. I feel like it needs to happen in the jail, in the prison system. I mean, I don't know what kind of reform is going on in there, but we're not seeing it when they come out, especially when this guy was out, February 18th?
February
and on
18th.
March 1st, they found the bodies of the elderly couple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how long did it take him to get out and kill two people?
Well, I mean, so, right, he was released on February 18th. There was an armed robbery on February 28th at a donut shop. Then March 1st, the bodies of the Giantinis are found. Then last Sunday, there was a home invasion robbery that they think this guy took part in. And then Tuesday was the attempted armed robbery of the jewelry store.
The jewelry store, right. So obviously he got out and was like, hey, this is great. I'm going to try this. And the same thing with the other story we were talking about. The police were saying he had on brand new shoes in his size,
mm-hmm.
nice white tennis shoes in his exact size. So somebody had to be helping him, or he stole those exact items. I mean, what are the odds? But so these people not only have the resources, but the help, and you know, they're getting weapons easily. So what is the Democrats' answer? Hey, no guns for anyone. Well, how's that working? Seriously?
Right.
Not.
Well, you know, and you had another story at Bearing Arms this week talking about the homicide clearance rate in Chicago this year, right? Which is, it's below 20%. I think is it below 15% right now?
14. Yep. It's 14. I want to say 14.7. You know me and my stats.
Mm-hmm.
But
14.7% clearance rate for homicides. Now, hopefully that goes up. You know, again, not every homicide can be solved right away and arrest made right away, but When the number of homicides has doubled over the same time period last year, Jen, and
right.
the clearance rate has plummeted, look, criminals feel emboldened. If they think they can get away with a crime, they're more likely to commit that crime.
That's right. And you know, okay, so here's the thing: their clearance rate is 14.7, but 16.6% of everyone who is shot in Chicago dies. So their kill rate is higher than their clearance rate. Does anyone see a problem with this? I'm like, this is disturbing. So the interim police chief down there, he's putting some measures into place that is going to hold superiors accountable for the police under him, which is good. I mean, that's a start. But I mean, man, you got to clean it up, Chicago. You are a hot mess. Allow some guns in there so people can defend themselves, you know?
Well, you know,
what
it's interesting.
It
well, look, I mean, you actually, it is possible for you to get a concealed carry license in Chicago. I think the Chicago Sun-Times had a story about this week that there are a couple of pretty high crime neighborhoods that have I think they're in the top five per capita neighborhoods with concealed carry permits. So that's good.
Right, but they also have the highest number of hours that you need to complete training. They're
no rangers in Chicago.
Extremely outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So how are the people who live in these high crime areas supposed to afford, number one, the application fee, and number two, have the time to take all of this training because they are busy working 2 to 3 jobs? These are the people who need the help, right?
Yep. Listen, I'm with you. And I'd love to see some real reform there, especially, you know, reform being led by the Chicago area. But I don't think we're going to see that. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, has anybody heard from him?
I think he's in hiding.
I think so. I mean, because, you know, look, Rahm Emanuel is still very much under a lot of scrutiny and criticism for release of this dash cam video.
Right.
And, you know, look, you've had people calling for him to step down. I don't think Rahm Emanuel wants to mention the word Chicago Police Department in public. And I think that's part of the problem here.
You know what?
That you've got
Bernie Sanders launched ads like against Rahm Emanuel. What the heck is going on if you have a presidential hopeful launching ads against a mayor? Why is he still in office? Why isn't Chicago doing something?
It's the Chicago way, Jen.
It's the Chicago way that it is.
Well, listen, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but go take a nap. Go feel better.
Oh, God. Thank you.
Rest up, and hopefully we get to see you down here soon.
You know what? I am going to try to sleep this weekend, and I really want to take that trip. I'm very excited to come down and meet John Murphy and do a little bit of training and come and see you and the little kids. Oh, and your kids, too.
Actually, the little baby goats are gone. But we might have more by the time you arrive.
Well, all right. I'll allow it.
We'll do our best. I'm not going to perform like a goat cesarean or anything like that, but we'll do what we can.
Get her very excited or take her for a walk or surprise her.
Boo! I'm going to go scare my goats this weekend. All right. They're not fainting goats, so it won't be nearly as amusing. But listen, feel better.
And now I'll be posting videos.
There you go. We'll talk to you soon. You too. Jen Jakes, they say laughter is the best medicine, so hopefully that was like some ibuprofen for Jen. Coming up, top of hour two, we've got more of the day's top stories. Also, Amy Hunter, NRA ILA media liaison, coming up next hour. Daniel Gelertner, writing in National Review, liberals want your car keys and your large sodas and your probably your non-smart guns as well. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this.
Speaking with Jonathan Rockett with the Shooting Club. Jonathan, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. I'm fantastic. Good to be here.
Well, you got a cool product. We were talking a little bit the other day, and I had to grab you guys over to talk about it. Tell me what is, and tell everyone else, what is the Shooting Club?
The Shooting Club is the world's first smartphone app that connects shooters across the country in competition for cash and prizes while promoting gun safety. We found that accidents happen with guns because people aren't proficient with them. They sit in a drawer. They don't know how to mm-hmm. use them. Maybe you've been to a shooting range once or twice, but if you're rusty, it doesn't really matter. So we found that if we can find a way to reward people and make it fun and give away money, then people will take it a little bit more seriously. So we have a proprietary handicapping system which allows shooters who are very new beginners all the way up to retired cops and military to compete against one another on a fair playing field.
Dude, what a great concept. So, all right, so I got a lot of questions for you here. How does it work, how did it go from this, hey, I got this great idea, to something that you're just getting ready to launch now in the App Store?
The whole idea started two Thanksgivings ago. My dad and I were talking. I was visiting him out in Houston, Texas, and he had commented he just got a new handgun, and his brother, who lives in Louisiana, had gotten one also. And they were trash-talking a little bit about who's a better shot. Mm. And he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a website where we could upload pictures of our targets and see who was a better shot? My regular business and my background is in web development and design, and I said, you know what, that's a really good idea. We looked, and there was nothing like that out there, so we decided to build it ourselves. Two years later, here we are.
Wow, that is so cool. All right, so it's called the Shooting Club. How does it work?
So you download the free app from the iPhone store or from the Google Play store.
Got it.
And you find a local range using GPS on your phone if you've never been to a range. At the local range, you purchase one of our official competition targets. You scan the QR code, and then you take the target, which is very, very unique and fun, which is really the secret sauce of what we do. It's really four targets in one. You shoot it according to the rules. You use the app itself, which uses your native camera to take a picture, scores it, handicaps you, and uploads it into your activity feed so all your friends and followers and fellow gun lovers can see your scores.
That is so awesome. What a great idea.
You can even form private groups that are just for maybe a couple of buddies that are for your own private competitions as well.
And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, we're always talking about here on NRA News, how important it is to keep the shooting sports and hunting and everything related to that, the Second Amendment, everything related, keep it vibrant, keep it growing, keep it relevant. And what a great way to do this, to actually be able to merge. Because the biggest thing is, people get so caught up in technology, they actually don't go out and shoot anymore. But this merges technology with going out and shooting.
And it makes it social. We found that if you have a buddy that lives in another state and you both love to shoot, but you never have a chance to go together to a range and make it a social activity, now we've removed the geographic and the time borders to do that.
Big.
As you follow people, you can post your stuff to Facebook. You can form your own private groups, upload pictures. Hey, I just got a brand new 9mm. I can't wait to try it out, etc. And what we found is this is bringing in some of the growing interest groups, such as women and millennials, who are newer to shooting sports, and it gives them a platform to really take it and run with it.
Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Shooting
Club? You can go to theshootingclub.com or look for the app, The Shooting Club, in your app store.
Jonathan Rocket, The Shooting Club, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome back. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Amy Hunter, NRA ILA Media Liaison, joining us. We'll talk about the West Virginia legislative override of permitless carry. Also, hearings in Maryland this week. Daniel Gelertner at Detach.com has got a piece of National Review. Liberals want your car keys. He says that the cover story of Time Magazine, the March 7th edition, makes the, quote, increasingly compelling case for why you shouldn't be allowed to drive. No. Because I thought driverless cars were all about, you know, more freedom and less worry and hassle for you. No. Nope. Once again, the argument comes down to you shouldn't be allowed to do something that you've been allowed to do. Not anymore. The claim is that computerized cars are safer drivers than humans, or will be, and the logical thing is to ban humans from driving altogether. Yeah. He says, in one of the sillier arguments that he's encountered in print this decade, Time author Matt Vella notes that, quote, there is no right to drive in the U.S. Constitution. Last time I checked, he says, it was enshrined right next to the right to breathe and the right to wear socks. He says, this is pat leftist thinking. Individuals want X. Individuals are incapable of doing X efficiently by themselves. Therefore, X should be provided for them by the experts. Right? Individuals want public safety. Individuals are incapable of protecting themselves efficiently by themselves. Therefore, people should be protected by law enforcement only. Or armed guards, if you got them. Vella says that the contrarians, you know, those who say, hey, I can drive a car, often raise the vexed question of how it can be ethically acceptable to have a car make a life or death choice. For example, to allow a car to choose between killing a dozen bystanders in the road or instead swerving and killing its lone occupant. Rather than attempting an answer, even an examination of this serious subject, Vella writes that these and plenty of other objections will provide ammunition as Americans' libertarian id struggles to hold on to the keys. Yes, bitterly clinging to our car keys. Your betters have spoken. And they want to take your car away. We'll talk about it again with Daniel coming up a little bit later on in the hour. In hour three, we have the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. I realize that this story that we were talking about with Jen Jakes could be both our hero and our deal of the day. This attempted jewelry store robber killed by the jewelry store owner, who, as it turns out, again, a person of interest, linked allegedly to three incidents in Apple Valley, California, at the ripe old age of 20, again, just released from prison, at the age of 20, with previous crimes of burglary, possession of stolen property, rape, grand theft, trespassing, sexual battery. And what's amazing is you're going to have people in California who say that that this case shows, the need for more gun control laws. They won't want to talk about Keon Bailey, the individual. They won't want to talk about how a 20-year-old man managed to get out of prison on parole with a rap sheet that long in such a short period of his life. They won't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about that because, again, there are a lot of individuals like Keon Bailey in California and across the country who have those lengthy records, who have little time behind bars to show for it, and who until, again, they end up on the front page of the paper, they end up leaving the nightly news, or in this case, they're shot and killed by an armed citizen. Their stories don't get covered because this is the norm. A criminal caught in the revolving door of justice is a dog bites man story. It's something that is so common that it is seen as not worthy of coverage. And yet, to me, it seems like this is a trend. This is a pattern. This is something that is, again, this is not an anomaly. It is worthy of coverage because most people think, gosh, you know, if this guy's got a record, he's rape conviction, stolen property, burglary, he's going to be behind bars for a long period of time. And if that's not the case, I would think that most people would say that is, in fact, a story that is worth covering, that is worth talking about. But we have another armed citizen story for you coming up in about an hour. And another deal of the day, unfortunately. Also have a good guy story. And we've got an update for you out of Georgia as well. Campus carry legislation, House Bill 859. Passing out of the Georgia State Senate today by a vote of 37 to 17. This bill now heads to Governor Nathan Deal for his consideration. Governor Deal has expressed support for the measure in the past, but it's a good idea if you're a Georgia gun owner to contact Governor Deal. If you've got a student who goes to school in Georgia, it's a good idea to contact the governor. If you're thinking about helping your kid go to school, if you're thinking about going to school in Georgia, make sure you contact the governor as well. House Bill 859 allows Georgia weapons license holders to carry when they are in or on certain buildings or real property owned by or leased to any public technical school, vocational school, college, university, other institution of post-secondary education. This bill, again, has already passed the House, passing the Senate today by a vote of 37 to 17. So it was not a particularly close vote there in the state of Georgia. And Georgia could become the next state with campus carry laws on the books, which would be a good thing because, you know, there have been a number of crimes there on college campuses in the state of Georgia this year. As a matter of fact, Georgia State University, as we mentioned, had to shut down their student library because of the number of armed robberies that was occurring there. And it's not that Georgia is a, or Georgia college campuses are more violent than other college campuses. It's that college campuses are not crime free. You know this. We know this. Everybody except for the, anti-gun activists who, decry these campus carry measures seem to understand that colleges are not crime free. Here you go. University of Minnesota, student robbed at gunpoint Wednesday afternoon just a few blocks off campus. That was reported by WCCO on March the 10th. Southern Illinois University robbed at gunpoint. A student robbed at gunpoint Thursday evening walking to his girlfriend's home, which is about 200 yards from the west side of campus. That was yesterday as well. We talked about Winthrop University down in South Carolina. They're putting in a call box after a robbery there. Kent State student killed during an off-campus robbery last month. The teenagers accused of killing that student have had their charges transferred to an adult court. That happened earlier this week. 17-year-old Marquis Greer had his charge transferred. 17-year-old Ty Krimling had his charges bound over last week. Both bonds set at $2 million. They are accused of being in a group that shot 18-year-old Nick Massa to death during a robbery at a Kent apartment on Super Bowl Sunday. Again, colleges are not crime-free. College students are often chosen as victims, and faculty members too. Individuals on or coming off of that college campus or going to that college campus, again, often seen as easy targets for criminals who know that their victims are likely to be unarmed and unable or unwilling to fight back. It happens, unfortunately. Bradley University had a robbery. A Lincoln University student killed in an off-campus shooting a couple of days ago. Case Western Reserve University robbery happening there a couple of days ago. Apparently two suspects there. Southeast Missouri State University, two men robbed and beaten by five other men. That was a week ago. And these stories are real. And what is also real are the campus carry policies in eight states that have already been implemented. In some cases, again, you can go back years to Utah, Colorado. You can look at what has happened in those states with the implementation of campus carry. And the answer is not much other than people are able to protect themselves. It's not like crimes have exploded on these campuses. It's not like you have reports of drunken, debauched students who are also concealed carry holders who are acting irresponsibly. Those stories aren't there. What you have right now in this debate are facts on one side of the argument and fear on the other side. You know, we've seen the, I guess it was the Atlantic had a couple of stories this week about campus carry, what a horrible thing it would be. And their arguments typically boil down to, these individuals who are currently in my class, who are currently concealed carriers, who are responsibly carrying everywhere else except campus, are going to turn into someone completely different than who they are if they're allowed to carry on campus. And I'm afraid of that. As a matter of fact, in Georgia today, Capitol Police arrested a Kennesaw State University professor who tried to display a sign protesting a bill, the campus carry bill. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says witnesses said that the woman had a sign critical of the bill on the fourth floor of the Capitol near the audience gallery of the state Senate. Now, it is not the Capitol Police are enemies of the First Amendment, but signs are banned in some areas of the Capitol. Witnesses said the woman resisted when officers tried to take the sign from her. They then took her to the ground as they arrested her, charged with obstruction and disrupting the General Assembly. University officials released a statement saying that they were aware of the arrest. Quote, we have the utmost respect for the General Assembly, and while we support appropriate expressions of opinion, we do not condone the disruptive activities associated with this incident. Huh. I wonder what the sign said, just out of curiosity. Certainly in opposition to campus carry. I'm kind of curious. Keep me safe from drunk and irresponsible college students. Maybe that's what it said. You know, again, I don't think the professor has anything to worry about. She should talk to maybe some of her colleagues in places like Utah and Colorado. We haven't seen this this level of opposition to campus carry in other states. It really started with Texas and the group UT Gun Free or Gun Free UT that decided, well, we're going to challenge this legally. We're going to build our circle of safety with our books. We're going to carry sex toys as a protest on the first day of classes next year. You've seen one professor say, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to Australia and teach. Another professor said that campus carry is one of the reasons why he is leaving the University of Texas to go back to the University of Pennsylvania, because they don't want to be around these students. But I've yet to see one of those professors even acknowledge that campus carry is the law in other states and that their colleagues have been on campus with concealed carry holders for years and there hasn't been a problem. There hasn't been an issue. In fact, I've yet to see any of these professors acknowledge that they are interacting with concealed carry holders off campus every day. It's almost like they've compartmentalized that information. They don't really want to think about that fact. That off campus, there are lots of concealed carry holders. And I'm sure these professors are running into them, whether they realize it or not. But they don't want to think about that. Again, it kind of undercuts the argument here that they're trying to make. So they'll just discard that information. Now, the proposal in Georgia, the campus carry bill that's headed to Governor Deal's desk, exempts athletic facilities and student housing, including the fraternity or sorority houses. But obviously, off-campus housing, that you're, if you're a student, you know, renting an apartment or whatever, you would be able to carry to and from your residence. So again, the bill heading to Governor Nathan Deal, WSB in Atlanta, Channel 2, says opponents say allowing guns on campus will put students in harm's way and make police officers' jobs more difficult. Supporters argue people should be able to defend themselves. Well, shouldn't they? All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, Amy Hunter, NRA ILA Media Liaison, will join us on the program. Daniel Gelertner coming up a little bit later on in the hour, talking about the a connection between driverless cars and gun control laws. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting. But it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon. Bat Masterson, Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure. The first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And so it's almost 1,000 a day. Yeah. Oh. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, you know, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
You're an American. That means you're free to defend your life. But Carol Bound is no longer with us because the state of New Jersey denied her that right. When her convicted felon ex-boyfriend smashed her car windows, she got a restraining order. Despite having home security cameras and an alarm system, she feared for her life. So she applied for a handgun permit. More than a month later, and just 2 days before her death, she demanded an update. Her application was still processing. Carol Bound didn't choose to be utterly defenseless when her predator stabbed her to death in her driveway 2 days later. That choice was made by the state of New Jersey. Government policies that deny us our right to defend our lives are not just ineffective, they are immoral. If you refuse to surrender your life to the dictates of your government, speak out. You can make a difference. The 5 million men and women of the National Rifle Association of America fight for you. We are freedom's safest place.
We don't rise up to the occasion, but instead fall back on our level of training.
Champions spend hours practicing for the smallest improvements. In order not to be a victim, it's important that you have a plan.
That's the perfect time to take your shot.
I am Gabby Franco, and I'll see you next time in another episode of Tips and Tactics, sponsored by Cabela's Outdoor Fun.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Closing off the week in a good way. Campus carry legislation on its way to the governor in Georgia. We've got NRA ILA Media Liaison Amy Hunter with us on the program right now. How you doing, Amy?
I'm great, Cam. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk with you as well. It was a fantastic seeing you out at CPAC. Hope that you didn't get the CPAC plague, did you?
No, I'm lucky, but my boss is at home sick, so it did not miss her.
It was just ruthless this year. Well, I'm glad that you were spared. So I mentioned campus carry on its way to Governor Deal in Georgia, which is fantastic news. But we also in West Virginia had a legislative override of Governor Tomlin's veto of permitless carry earlier this week.
We did, and that's a huge success in West Virginia. We're very pleased. It was an effort, really, that's been years coming. There was a veto, the governor vetoed a similar bill last year, but he did it right at the end of the legislative session, so there was no way to do an override. So this year, we did. We were successful after he vetoed it in getting it overridden, and it becomes the law in 90 days.
That is fantastic. And the votes, by the way, in West Virginia, you'd only need that simple majority to override a legislative or a governor's veto. But they had that and more. I mean, these votes really were fairly lopsided, Amy.
In terms of for the override here?
Yeah. Overwhelming support, I think, legislatively.
It was a bipartisan. It passed both sides. I mean, it was really an example of legislators listening to their constituents. You know, I mean, there was a lot of support for this bill, and it was voted in from both sides of the aisle. It was really a success.
Well, what kind of effort did we see from gun owners in West Virginia? I mean, were they making contact with their lawmakers? Were they contacting the governor's office, urging him not to veto the bill?
Tens and tens of thousands of emails sent, of contact made. I mean, this was really an example of a state coming together to protect their rights. I mean, it was truly extraordinary to watch. And I think every legislator got hundreds of emails, if not more, from their constituents letting them know their support for this really important piece of legislation.
And we should talk a little about the legislation as well, because one thing we should point out, this does not get rid of the concealed carry license in West Virginia, right?
No, it doesn't. You can still have a concealed carry license if you would like to take advantage of the reciprocity agreements that allows. What this does is just for, if you want to carry concealed in the state, you don't have to get the government's permission first. You can go through and get that permit if you would like I said, the benefits that awards. But, you know, one of the ways we've been discussing this is open carry is already legal in that state. So anyone can, you know, have their firearm on their person openly and you know, go about their lives. But if the second they put on a coat or a jacket, they're breaking the law. And so what this law does is it just makes it just easier, you know, to arm yourself and to, carry your firearm around without having to worry about what you're wearing. I mean, that's kind of really what it comes down to.
Yeah. We also talked with Delegate Sarah Blair, who is not yet 21 years of age. And you know, as a lawmaker, she said she's received death threats, but she's not legally allowed to carry. She can't get a concealed carry license. When this goes into effect, though, 18, 19, 20-year-olds will be able to apply. They can legally own a firearm, but now they'll be actually able to legally apply to get a concealed carry license, right?
Yeah, this is one of the cool parts about this bill, and I think it was really made stronger by Delegate Sarah Blair. I mean, she was the perfect person to introduce and sponsor this bill because it directly affects her. And so that's one of the, this is one of the things that makes the bill different this year from last year. And so adults, you know, who are 18 to 21, who can serve elected office, serve in the military, and vote, can apply to get a concealed carry permit. They'll have to go through a little bit of training and get, it's a special kind of provisional type permit, but it does enable these adults who we give so much other responsibility to take, you know, responsibility of their own personal safety.
Absolutely. All right. So in Maryland this week, we also had some hearings here. I know, you know, it's Maryland, Amy, so I know that there were some anti-gun bills coming up here, but what were the lawmakers discussing in Annapolis this week?
Well, yesterday was, you know, what they call Gun Day. There were a lot of different bills that they were hearing. The two that kind of stand out, they were discussing criminalization of private sales of long guns. And they were discussing making higher ed zones weapon-free. So, you know, there's a host of problems with each of those. But those were the two, I think, major standouts among all that went on yesterday.
All right. Now, right now in Maryland, what is the law currently when it comes to these sort of gun-free school zones? This is left up to the individual educational institutions?
Yeah, okay, so right now it's left up to the individual educational institutions, as you said, but each campus, every university has said gun-free zone, right? And so, but right now, if you do happen by accident or for whatever reason, say you were goose hunting in the morning and you had your rifle in your trunk and you drove, you know, you got to class at Salisbury to, you know, get there on time and you left your rifle in your trunk. Right now, that would be a violation of school policy, but it would be handled in the school system, right? So whatever, you faced as a result of that oversight would be within the school. What they were discussing yesterday would change that and it would essentially make it a criminal penalty. And this is where the real problem comes in because the way they've written it, it sort of interacts with federal law in a certain way that would make it now, if you do make that mistake and you are caught on campus with a firearm, even if the judge, in your case, just gives you a slap on the wrist because he realizes it was a mistake and he gives you a $50 fine, because it's a charge that's punishable by up to 3 years, that automatically makes you a prohibited person for life. So that's where the real problem with this bill comes in. And it's one of those technicalities that, you know, it's hard to discuss if you don't have enough time to kind of explain it. But
right.
That's really where we're, you know, one of the major things we're focused on.
So did what kind of action was taken on that bill yesterday?
Well, it just discussed, and
okay.
I could go into detail about how it was discussed, but they're going to vote on that as early as this afternoon.
Okay. So what should gun owners in Maryland be doing right now if they were not able to make it out to Annapolis? And I know that there were gun owners who were there, and that's fantastic. But who should they be contacting?
They need to be contacting their legislators, and we have that all set up on NRAILA.org. So it's really important that every law-abiding gun owner in Maryland gets on NRAILA.org and contacts their legislator. It's all laid out for them there because, you know, our legislators just need to hear from us about how, you know, how their constituents feel about these bills.
Absolutely. And, you know, unfortunately, we know that Maryland, you know, they passed the Firearm Safety Act in 2013, Amy. Last year we saw homicides reach a 20-year high in Baltimore, Maryland per capita.
Yeah.
I think it was an all-time high actually per capita.
Per capita was all-time. Yeah.
And you know, we saw a lawmaker in Maryland yesterday say that they're not going to stop this push for gun control until the death toll hits zero. And they're going to be trying for a long time because they're going in the opposite direction right now.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead.
This one gets me riled up. I'm from Maryland, so. But yeah, I just like you're saying, I mean, none of these bills, I mean, there is a crime problem in certain parts of Maryland, for sure, and none of these bills address that. All of these bills go after law-abiding gun owners, and that's what's so bothersome about it. I mean, they can say they're pushing it for reasons to get, you know, these incidents down to zero, and yet they're pushing for bills that only affect people that aren't committing crimes. So, and again, as I said, as a Maryland resident, it gets me emotional.
I don't blame you. When we were up in Harrisburg at the Great American Outdoor Show, obviously there were a lot of folks from Maryland who came up and attended the show, and I got an earful, Amy, from so many folks who live in Western Maryland, Central Maryland, and they are just so disappointed and so frustrated with the lawmakers for not listening to them. And again, it's a lot of lawmakers from the Baltimore area, from the D.C. suburbs, who really just, they seem not to care what these folks think.
Well, and let me give you an example of that. So, one of the things they discussed yesterday was, making private sales of long guns would be criminalized under this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just for example, Maryland has criminalized private sale of handguns since the 1990s. Okay, so since the 1990s, people have had to go to the state police. Two people have had to go to the state police and have that sale go through, under the like I said, through the state police. What effect has that had on handgun crime in Baltimore? I mean, it has not, like you said, crime in Baltimore per capita is at an all-time high. And now they're introducing this bill to do the same thing for long guns. It just doesn't seem to make logical sense. The problem that they're trying to fix and the laws that they're proposing to do it just don't jive.
Absolutely. But as you say, that focus is always on the law-abiding gun owner, right? And it's always about making being a legal, lawful gun owner a little bit more difficult. And meanwhile, we don't hear much about making life more difficult for the violent criminals in Maryland.
I'm not hearing it. Not in these bills. I'm not seeing it anywhere.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Well, it is. I would love to say Amy just moved to Virginia, but that's not an option, ultimately. I mean, we can't all just try to pack into one state and make sure that that state respects the Second Amendment. We've got to ensure that no matter where we live, that our Second Amendment rights are strong and safe and secure.
Hey, absolutely. I'm in agreement there. Yeah.
Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend.
Yes, Kim, it's always a pleasure. You too.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. Amy Hunter, join us, NRA ILA Media Liaison with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. I was going to tell Amy maybe she could just go visit Virginia for a little bit, but she probably does that enough during the work week. Daniel Gelertner coming up, writing a National Review. Liberals want your car keys. We have the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, coming up top of hour three. The deal of the day, good guy as well, Derek Hunter. From WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland, on the gun day in Annapolis yesterday. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz and the Morning News. I hope he didn't get the CPAC plague. Tony was there. He seemed to be fine. Probably fended it off with all of that cigar smoke. We are also, again, keeping our eyes on several other stories out there, including the passage of campus carry. In the state of Georgia, taking a look at some of the media reaction to the campus carry bill passing out of the state Senate, House Bill 859, now headed to Governor Nathan Deal's desk in the state of Georgia. As I mentioned, The Atlantic had a piece yesterday about the armed campus in the age of anxiety. This was written by a Georgia Tech professor. Let's see. Looking here at a story from this was from before the vote was cast. I like finding the quotes from lawmakers and citizens and some of the local stories here. Representative Carla Drenner with the Georgia House Democratic Caucus said, "I have a daughter who's 19. She said, well, I don't think that tomorrow, if the bill passes, that my daughter is going to feel safer on a college campus. Just the opposite. She said, I don't think that even a 21-year-old is mentally capable of being able to manage themselves in an environment where there is drinking, drug use, social pressures, et cetera, and then given a weapon. Let's unpack that for a second. I have a couple of kids who've gone to college. And honestly, I would have felt better had my daughter been able to carry. My daughter lived on campus all 4 years. She had a job off campus as a waitress. She worked the night shift. She did not have a car. She rode a bicycle to and from her job at night. Yeah, you're damn right. I would have felt a hell of a lot better had she been able to get her concealed carry license and carry when she turned 21. I would have felt better. Now, Representative Drenner's daughter, who's 19, is not going to be old enough to carry. As to whether or not she's going to be safer, look again at what is happening in Georgia right now, where you have armed robberies on campus in the library at Georgia State, where you have had armed robberies in the dorms at Georgia Tech, while these campuses were supposedly gun-free zones. And you're really going to be worried about the lawful, licensed, concealed carry holder? That's what's going to make you think the campus has become more dangerous? Not what is occurring right now? And as to this statement, I don't think that even a 21-year-old is mentally capable of being able to manage themselves in an environment where there is drinking, drug use, social pressures, et cetera, and then given a weapon. Well, shouldn't you take away their car keys, too? Oh, my goodness gracious, liberals want your car keys. We're going to be talking with Daniel Glurner about that in just a couple of minutes. If that is your argument, that there is no way that a college student, given this environment here where there's drinking and drugs and social pressures, there's no way that they could be a responsible concealed carry holder. Could they? Is there any way that they could be a responsible driver? Is there any way, honestly, is there any way that they could be a responsible adult? Sounds to me like if you don't think a 21-year-old is mentally capable of being able to manage themselves in that environment, the answer would be to get them the hell out of that environment. By the way, aren't these campuses supposed to be drug-free zones, too? I just out of curiosity. I mean, if we're going to talk about, you know, laws being broken, maybe there's a place to start. Or underage drinking? Is that not an issue? Are we supposed to pretend that college students aren't violating laws right now, but somehow the one that they're not violating would be the gun-free zone law? Because, again, I'm seeing a lot of individuals on college campuses committing crimes who aren't concealed carry holders. It's the kitchen sink argument. Just throw whatever you can. Try to make it stick. We're going to chill free speech. We're not going to be able to speak our minds if a campus carry comes to pass. The drunk, drugged out college students who are also concealed carry holders are going to cause all kinds of mayhem. Students just aren't responsible enough. By the way, what about the faculty member who's the concealed carry holder? What about the administrator who's the concealed carry holder? What about the 24-year-old teaching assistant? What about the 26-year-old college freshman who's a veteran? What about the fact that we are talking about people who are not just concealed carry holders on campus, they're concealed carry holders off campus too. And they manage to navigate society and all of its social ills in a responsible, lawful manner. Again, they don't want to have this conversation. They don't even want to think about where their argument would logically lead. Because it's not about logic for their arguments. It's about emotion. Nothing but. All right, when we return here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Daniel Glurner joining us. Liberals, he says, want your car keys and a whole lot more than that. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Mark Holyoke with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Sir, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great.
Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, great organization. Love the work you guys are doing and have done. We've got new things to talk about. First, Mark, tell folks who don't know, what is the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation all about? What do you guys do?
Well, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, we're a wildlife and land conservation group, for lack of a better term. You know, you have Ducks Unlimited for ducks. We are that for elk. Basically, we look out for wild elk and for the wild places where they live. We conserve land, we protect land, and we look to improve habitat all across elk country.
What are you doing? Anything new?
We've got some new things going in the fire. We just launched a campaign, a social media campaign, a digital campaign, if you will, Hunting is Conservation. And people hear that and they're like, hunting is conservation. What does that mean exactly?
How is that possible, Mark? Tell us.
How is that possible? Well, basically, and a lot of hunters don't even know this or quite understand it, but hunters put so many dollars on the ground and already have such a care for the environment and animals as it is. But when you look at the licenses they pay, the fees they pay, the donations that they make to conservation groups like ours, and then when you look back in time and you look at the whole Pittman-Robertson Act, which, if you're not familiar with that, back in the early 1900s, a lot of wildlife was going away for different reasons. It was being hunted on the market, so to speak. And hunters stepped up at that time and said, hey, we have a problem here. A lot of our species are going away. And so they self-imposed a tax on themselves, on their guns, on their ammunition, on their bows and their arrows. And the fishery folks later did this later with fishing equipment as well. So since that time, we've generated more than $8 billion that's gone toward conservation efforts. And so hunters are the backbone of conservation efforts since then and today.
I'll tell you what, Mark, you couldn't have explained that more eloquently. I talk about that all the time, why hunters are the number one conservationists, and that is the best. I'm going to clip that and send it around to my friends. No, it was awesome, because that is so important to people, especially those, you said, within the hunting community, but people who aren't hunters understand, say, oh, hunters are out there trying to kill all the wildlife and destroy the underground, and it's not true.
Yeah, it's not true, and it is. It's the bottom line. Like I said, not just the caring and the connections that are made between so many of us who live in cities nowadays, but it's the actual funding of paying for and providing funding for state wildlife agencies. They're the ones, the fish and game agencies, right. They're the ones who take care of wildlife management. They're
huge.
The ones who look at conservation efforts. And so our funding as a hunting community takes care of that and provides what's needed to make that happen.
Yeah, and you know, once again, people who don't understand that, if all the hunters, Mark, were to go out there and kill all the wildlife and destroy all the forest, then what would they do to continue to hunt? So it behooves
right.
them, besides
right.
their fees they pay, it behooves them to take care of the populations, to control them, help cull them when necessary, grow them when necessary, and also take care of the habitat as well. So, okay, how did Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation get started?
Well, it began back in 1984. There were four just good old boy hunters in northwestern Montana, and they cared for the elk, and they cared for the surroundings around them, and they thought, well, you know, who's looking after this particular animal? I mean, if you hunt, if it's turkeys, if it's deer, if it's ducks, whatever, you know, we know what that's like to be a hunter. But to hunt elk, I mean, they live in certain places and certain landscapes that are incredible. And at that time, there was no particular organization looking out just for elk. And so they decided and they pooled their efforts, and one of them almost caused a divorce because he took college funding for his kids out
Ooh,
of the bank and okay. applied it to this organization, and
wow.
it hung on by a thread. And then today the ball's rolled forward, and as of right now we have more than 220,000 members and more than 11,000 volunteers, and they're just doing great work for us.
That's a guy who's dedicated. Foolish, crazy, but dedicated. Yeah. So who's the typical member of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation?
A typical member is just someone who cares to make just a little bit of a difference, to not just be so solar focused on crosshairs on a game, but to understand what that really means. And so, I mean, we have people who are life members. We have people who donate decent sums of money. The bulk of our membership is just probably year-to-year members.
Mark Holyoke with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. About 20 seconds left. How can people get more information?
Just go to rmef.org. Also, follow our social media campaign right now that hunting is conservation, and we just appreciate the support.
rmef.org.
O-R-G.
Mark Holyoke, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, Farmville's Media Row right there. WVHL, Farmville Herald, NRA News not too far away. We're out on Main Street here in Farmville, Virginia. Daniel Gelertner riding in National Review, Liberals Want Your Car Keys. Daniel, how you doing, sir?
Hi, just fine, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you coming on the program. This is, I have to say, this is one of my pet issues because I really do like to drive. I love taking road trips. I love to be behind the wheel of a car. I have no interest in driverless cars. So when I saw the headline, I thought, oh, this is interesting. And then when I started reading this, As you point out, I mean, there are a lot of analogies here to this Time magazine cover story about why you should not be allowed to drive and why you shouldn't be allowed to do X, including perhaps own a firearm or own a non-smart gun. I think there are a lot of corollaries to the gun control debate here.
There really are. And this is an issue that's very dear to my heart as well, because I'm actually an NRA instructor as well. And so I've been deeply involved in both issues, and it's remarkable how much of an overlap there really is, with a sort of fundamental divide between, I'd say, conservatives on the one hand, basically, and not all, but perhaps a lot of them, and then the sort of leftist bureaucrat on the other hand. And the difference is between the leftists who have an inherent distrust of people versus the conservatives who have an inherent distrust of government. And so the natural instinct of the leftists, in whatever the case is, whether it's guns or cars or even being allowed to smoke or buy a large soft drink, is that people are really too dumb and irresponsible to make these decisions themselves, which is why we have the government to tell us exactly how we ought to live and make sure that we live lives not according to what we want to do, but according to what the government deems is safe and socially responsible.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you talk about the writer of this piece, Matt Vella, who calls these folks contrarians, people who disagree, who think that they have some sort of right to drive a car. There's nothing in the Constitution, he says, that says you get to drive a car. And the ethical considerations here, I thought this was fascinating, where he brings these up, right? What would happen if a car, if a computer has to decide between swerving off the road, possibly killing pedestrians, or continuing on the road and possibly killing the driver of a car? You say he doesn't even attempt to answer this. He just says that these and plenty of other objections will provide ammunition as America's libertarian id struggles to hold on to the keys. Like these are just brought up as, theoreticals that could never, ever possibly happen. So why even bother thinking about these things?
Exactly. It's really a remarkably condescending approach they take. He says these are some of the objections that people will bring up. And then instead of dealing with them, he says, and you know they're only bringing them up because they want to be really sneaky, as though they're just trying to get in the way of progress. And, you know, it's possible that they're real objections, but why should we even bother examining them? We know that they're obviously on the wrong side, what Obama would probably call the wrong side of history.
Yeah. You say that there is also a genuine emotional argument to be made. And we should reject the notion that an emotional argument is ipso facto worthless. Mayor Bill de Blasio, you're right, couldn't understand why New Yorkers laughed off his idea to replace Central Park's famous horse-drawn buggies with electric buggies. But, you know, again, if you're Bill de Blasio, right, you don't see the difference. What's the deal? It's one's horse-powered, one's electric-powered. You still got the buggy. Isn't that the important thing, Daniel? And yet, as I said going in here, I like to drive. I love to be behind the wheel of a car. I love to be in control of that vehicle. I drove from here to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for the Great American Outdoor Show. I'm planning on driving from Central Virginia to Louisville, Kentucky for the NRA annual meeting. I love to drive, and I don't want that taken away from me.
Absolutely. And this goes back to sort of the very beginning of the piece in Time where he argues that it should be okay to take away the right to drive because, after all, it's not explicitly guaranteed in the Constitution, which is really a ridiculous thing to say, because the whole point of the Constitution is not to outline what we can't do, but what the government can't do. And what liberals tend to pursue these days in terms of their philosophy is actually very similar to the fundamental Marxist concept, which is that people should only have what they need, you know, each according to his ability, to each according to what he needs. And the idea of need as being something that the government is capable of assessing is fundamentally, I think, un-American and unfree. The idea that we all have needs that are more or less exactly the same, and that perhaps we need some sort of transportation, so obviously the government knows what the best version of that is. The fact is that people, it's not a question of needs, it's a question of desires. Some people enjoy driving, and they should be allowed to do that because we live in America and we have the ability to choose what to do with the time we've created through the dint of our own hard work.
Absolutely. But as you say, there's this line of thought, individuals want X, whatever that is, whether it's to drive their car, to own firearms. Individuals are incapable of doing X efficiently by themselves. Therefore, X should be provided for them by the experts. And as you say, the experts are generally the government, often academics. Maybe they're the members of the chattering class. But rarely are we the experts in our own lives.
Yes, exactly, because once again, it goes to the fundamental leftist distrust of the individual, because I think in their view, the individual is basically a perpetual child. He never grows up. He always needs to be taken care of through every stage of his life. Just like in Obama's Life of Julia, the idea that at every stage of the game, little Julia will be taken care of. Little Julia is us, the individual American person who is incapable of making his own decisions. So fortunately, rather than be bothered with having to grow up and take personal responsibility and make our own decisions, we will just have administrators and bureaucrats deciding what is best for us and providing it to us.
Talking to you with Daniel Gelertner of Detached.com. Daniel, so I got to ask, how did you become an NRA firearms instructor? I mean, I know how you did it, but why did you become an NRA firearms instructor?
Well, I was very close to firearms when I grew up. And, you know, my granddad taught me how to shoot when I was 12, which I think is the appropriate thing to do. And when I was in college, I was on a pistol team. And actually, even though I went to a very typical East Coast liberal college, we made the pistol team the most popular undergraduate organization in the entire college because we offered safety courses every other week. And it was remarkable how many people just wanted to come to learn how to shoot safely. So I took out an instructorship so I'd be able to contribute to learning safe gun handling.
Really? That is awesome. It's fascinating that, I mean, your story, I think, is probably very typical of a lot of people, dad or grandfather, some older family member taught them how to use firearms. But the fact that you kept up with this and, you know, we talk a lot about, we were just talking about the Georgia campus carry bill that sent it to Governor Deal's desk today. You know, you're absolutely right that even in what we would think of as typically like anti-Second Amendment campuses, you often find that those rifle and pistol clubs are among the most popular student organizations out there. I remember at MIT talking with the coach there of the pistol team, and they welcome every student who wants to participate. And they are they have a ton of interest from students, a lot of them who, you know, show up on campus never having shot a gun before. But it's something that that they find very relaxing. It appeals to their engineering mindset and bent. And you've got a great MIT pistol team.
Yeah, it's and we've competed against them often, and we've often lost. but in any event, I think that the striking thing is that a lot of these people who, as you said, they grew up with no contact with firearms, and to a great extent, the sort of surrounding propaganda demonized firearms. And once they finally encounter it and they learn that it is a relaxing and engaging activity and also a very safe one, they're sort of shocked, and some of them even feel betrayed that they were bombarded for their entire lives with the idea that guns were some sort of evil instrument.
Well, imagine that, you know, actually a learning experience there at college. I didn't think those were allowed anymore.
It doesn't happen every day, that's for sure.
Right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, Daniel. It's a great piece. I encourage folks to check it out at National Review. Liberals Want Your Car Keys. We've tweeted this out at Cam and Company as well. Hope we can have you back on the program at some point, sir.
I'd be delighted. Thanks very much.
You bet. Have a good weekend. Daniel Gelertner joined us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, the CEO of Detach.com. Still to come on the program, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, coming up at the top of the hour. Also, Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News. If Hour 1 was the Salem Media Power Hour, then Hour 3 is going to be the Local Talk Radio Power Hour here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We're also, again, following all of the day's big stories for you, including the campus carry legislation that has been sent on to Governor Deal's desk in the state of Georgia. This while Georgia Tech professors say that they're incredibly worried about campus carry in the age of the anxious college student. These college students, if you're 18 years old, you were in kindergarten. This college professor said at the Atlantic, you're in kindergarten at 9/11. You have grown up in a world with perpetual war. You have grown up in an age of anxiety. One or two answers on your SAT can mean the difference between getting into a top-notch educational institution and having to go to, you know, Bumpkin State. These college students, when they arrive on campus, this professor says, they are already so freaked out. They are already so anxious about life that the slightest thing could set them off, which is why he is so concerned about the prospect of campus carry. which again tells me that there's not a lot of critical thinking that's going on among the professors on college campuses these days, much less college students. Let's hope they're learning it elsewhere, because I'm not sure that they're learning critical thinking from their professors. Because what this professor, again, doesn't really take into account is that these concealed carry holders in Georgia, if Governor Deal signs this bill into law, and if you're a Georgia gun owner, again, you should contact the governor's office. A, they're not 18. B, they're already concealed carry holders. Again, they're carrying off campus. And in any of the other states where we've had campus carry go into effect, we haven't seen these scenarios actually turn into reality in any of these states that have adopted campus carry. As a matter of fact, I mean, really, right up until Texas, again, you haven't even seen professors say, forget it, I'm not going to teach here. I don't recall, you know, Colorado passed its campus carry or its concealed carry law in 2003. College campuses were covered. The University of Colorado at Boulder objected to this, and they actually tried to put in place a campus carry ban. Finally, that went away, I think, in 2011, maybe 2012. There was a court challenge. They lost. They have to abide by state law, just like every other educational institution. That was just a few years ago. And I got to tell you, I don't remember any professor at the University of Colorado saying, I'm out of here. There was no UC gun-free. I know it's really CU, but that doesn't rhyme. There was no anti-gun faculty organization that got started there in Boulder, Colorado. And this is Boulder, Colorado we're talking about here. But we didn't see that level of freak out. Again, it wasn't until this year, campus carry in Texas, we started to see these professors throw critical thinking out the window and decide that campus carry is going to turn their campus into some Mad Max reality, even though it hasn't done that for society at large. Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Jason Redman, from Combat Wounded Coalition, and you know, obviously we've had Jason on the program as well talking about his book. Jason, how are you, sir?
I am awesome. I mean, obviously I'm out here at SHOT Show. You're in Vegas. You're with just amazing patriots who love this country, the Second Amendment. They love freedom. And you know me, that's all the things that I stand for.
Absolutely. And so you are out there. You're not just seeing the sights. I mean, you've got a product that you are showing off at SHOT Show this year, right?
That's right. We are pretty excited. So I have partnered with Miltac Knife and Tool Company. They are a great company based out of Texas. And they've been a huge supporter of Wounded Warriors, Special Operations Wounded Warrior, and they support us, Combat Wounded Coalition and Wounded Wear. And, you know, we just started talking, and I have always been a huge fan of edged weapons, of knives. And Craig Sword, the head of Miltac, said, hey, Jay, what do you think about making a knife for yourself, the Jason Redman Overcome Knife? And that was probably about 6 months ago, and it led to this amazing product right here, which this is the first prototype. This is the unveiling today. But this knife captures my life, and it was based off the idea. You've got the Tanto blades, which carries us back to the original samurai, you know, that warrior spirit. This knife is also similar, many aspects of it, to what I carried when I was wounded. It is designed for, you can use it with fighting, you know, the fighting pommel, single tang, single piece of metal, so great strength, great versatility. It can be a good fighting knife. It can be a good field knife. And the red and black actually represents the aspects of my life. Those who have read my book, The Forging and Reforging, know that the forging part was when I was a young, new leader, made some mistakes, almost ended my career, and had to dig myself out of that hole. So the black paracord represents that that period, the original forging. Of course, the red represents the blood I shed on the battlefield and the blood that so many other other warriors have shed. And so that is the forging and reforging. Of course, having the JR Overcome logo on it. So this nice of it is for anybody that has that mindset that I can overcome adversity. I tell you, working with Miltac a couple of years ago, I did a hog hunt. I used one of their knives, very similar to this, and I took down a I got a boar. Anybody that's never done that before, hunting wild boar with dogs and knives, it was amazing. But their knife, it did the trick. It was fast. It was efficient. And that boar was down quickly.
That is awesome. Our friend Ron Bellin invited me, actually, to go on a hog hunt that way. And, unfortunately, I had to pass up the opportunity, but I hope to go at some point because it sounded like no hunt that I've ever heard of before, Jason. I mean, it sounded like you are really getting back to. I mean, you're getting awfully primal when you're hunting hogs with knives and dogs.
You are, and you just get caught up in the energy. I'll be honest; it's one of the few things, maybe next to skydiving, that brings back that. That adrenaline rush that you would get when you were in combat before you would go into a building or before you were taking something down. I mean, the dogs start, you know, they catch scent of that boar, they go after it, and you're just running through the woods trying to go after these boars. The dogs try and pin it, and you go in with the knife. So all of this coming back together with the idea of creating that Overcome knife, you know, for a guy like me who got severely wounded, got put back together, you know, all of you know my motto, my mantra is overcome. It is what that's what I talk about. So pretty neat to work with Miltac and come full circle and now have this knife.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler. Starts right now. Coming up on the program this hour, Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland. On the Maryland Democratic Senator, he says, we will not stop our push for gun control until the death toll hits zero. And again, last year, 2 years after the Maryland Firearm Safety Act was passed in Maryland, signed by Governor Martin O'Malley, under the guise of public safety, this was supposed to make Maryland safer. This was supposed to make Baltimore safer. Homicides in Baltimore per capita hit an all-time high. In terms of the total number of homicides, it was a 20-year high. You have fewer people living in Baltimore now than you did 20 years ago, in part because the crime in Baltimore has been so bad for so long. But there's no reflection by lawmakers that, you know, maybe we're aiming our legislative tools in the wrong direction. Again, maybe casting this wide net over the entire state of Maryland, aiming our laws at the law-abiding gun owners. Maybe that's not the way to bring down violent crime in our most crime-ridden neighborhoods and communities. Nope. We're going to double down. We're going to triple down. We'll quadruple down if we have to. Just like they did in Washington, D.C. We'll get as close as we can to as near a ban as we can. And then when the crime rates don't go down, we'll blame Virginia. I mean, that's the argument. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz of the Morning News, will join us on the program later on in the hour as well. Right now, let's get to our Heroes of the Day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense. We'll start with a story out of Oklahoma. News Channel 10. In Tulsa, with a story out of Midwest City, a suburb of Oklahoma City. Authorities say an 18-year-old woman fatally shot her ex-boyfriend after he broke into her home. Happened early Thursday morning. Police say that the man broke in through a window in the home there on Willow Wind Drive. Police say he was shot to death by his ex-girlfriend who lives in the home with her mother. Midwest City Police Chief Brandon Klabe says there was a history of domestic violence between the man and woman. No arrests have been made. Looks like the 18-year-old was acting in self-defense. And in Minot, North Dakota, the Grand Forks Herald reporting on a woman who was able to defend herself from an intruder there in her home thanks to her handgun. I'm having a little trouble here with the story. Might have to come back to this story here in a moment or two. In fact, why don't we do that? All right, our deal of the day. You know, I got a couple of these too, unfortunately. The first deal of the day from the Columbus Dispatch in Columbus, Ohio. Now, the sentence itself is not the deal here. The headline, shooter in Far East Side murder sentenced to life. So a life sentence, eligible for parole after 35 years. That's a significant prison sentence. It's the fact that this individual, Nashawn Glenn Culverson, who got that 35-year sentence, it's the fact that he's 19 years old and he already has such a lengthy criminal history. A jury convicted Nashawn Glenn Culverson of murder last week and two counts of felonious assault. It was March 20th of last year when he opened fire on a minivan in a shopping plaza, killing a passenger. The driver and another passenger of the minivan were uninjured. Two eyewitnesses identified Nashawn Glenn Culverson as the man that they saw standing on the sidewalk and repeatedly firing a handgun at the minivan. Assistant Prosecutor James Lowe said the 19-year-old fired 10 shots into traffic from a crowded parking lot. He said, we're lucky that we're here on one homicide and not two, three, four, or five. A detective testified that Nashawn Glenn Culverson was a member of the James and Livingston Hot Boys, a gang affiliated with the Bloods. At the time of the shooting, he may have committed the crime to impress fellow gang members. And the Columbus Dispatch says he had a lengthy criminal history as a juvenile and as an adult. Now, keep in mind, again, he's 19. This murder happened a year ago. He was 18. How can he have racked up a lengthy criminal history as an adult? And yet somehow he was able to. In addition to the guilty plea or the guilty verdict for the murder charge and the two counts of felonious assault, jurors also found him guilty of one gang specification and three gun specifications, and the judge convicted him of having a gun despite a previous felony conviction at the age of 19. So what was Nashawn Glenn Culverson doing out on the streets? You know, and again, this is one of those crimes. Made the front page of the paper. Led the nightly news. And then all of a sudden, Nashawn Glenn Culverson elevated to a position where a plea bargain is unlikely. Some media attention and a media spotlight put on him and on prosecutors and on the his role and place in the criminal justice system. But what happened to Nashawn Glenn Culverson before this trial? How can you rack up at the age of 19 a lengthy criminal history, including other felony convictions, and still be out on the streets at the age of 19? Did he ever do any serious time behind bars for any of those previous crimes, including the felony conviction? And if not, did Nashawn Glenn Culverson think that he could beat the system? Did he assume that nothing would happen? Did he assume that the pattern that he had seen and the pattern that he had lived in the criminal justice system up to that point would just continue on? He is one, as I said, of our deals of the day. Our other deal of the day from the Chicago Tribune. And this story is a little bit different, but it's worth pointing out. Riverside, Illinois, a 36-year-old man, Cyrus Chaminara, charged last week with felony stalking, felony criminal damage to property, and misdemeanor criminal trespass to state-supported land. This guy is accused of stalking a teacher there in Riverside for the past 14 years. Yeah, for 14 years. Chaminara, according to the Chicago Tribune, has been arrested several times in four states since 2002 for stalking, harassing, criminal damage, and other crimes. And he keeps doing it. Same person, he keeps doing it. In the most recent case, the Tribune says, he allegedly vandalized the victim's 2013 Jeep Wrangler in the Riverside Brookfield High School parking lot back on February 29th. The victim told police that he's had problems for the last 14 years with an individual whom he had testified against in court in 2002. And since then, this guy's been arrested for stalking, harassing, and other crimes in Illinois, Florida, Arizona, New York. According to the Riverside, Illinois Police Department, he's also arrested and convicted in Arizona for stalking Jeff Hornacek, the former NBA player, the basketball coach. It was in 2002, Chaminara was arrested for trespassing at a school in Berwyn, Illinois, during basketball and female cheerleading practice. Teacher confronted him, later testified against him in court. He was convicted. After Chaminara's most recent arrest, he told police that basically that teacher ruined his life by testifying against him in court. Couldn't get a job. Told investigators that over the next 14 years, he stalked the victim, searched for him on the internet so he could learn about his employment, his personal life, his financial history, followed the victim from time to time in his car when he'd go shopping, followed him when he'd go to the movies. He threw bricks through the windows of the victim's home, followed the victim in his car, harassing him on the streets. In each case, he was arrested and charged, usually with misdemeanors, ranging from criminal damage to property to disorderly conduct. 14 years this has gone on. And again, when the arrest has been made, it's typically been for misdemeanor charges. When he was arrested last week, Chaminara was on probation for convictions in Arizona and Illinois. He was also wanted on a reckless driving warrant out of Key West, Florida. He's been arrested, they say, over the years for theft, damage to property, assault, obstruction of justice, invasion of privacy, aggravated assault, stalking, harassment, traffic offenses. It seems like the most severe punishment that he has received was 5 years of felony probation. That's it. Sounds like Mr. Chaminara has never really done any time behind bars for stalking at least one of them, maybe two. For more than a decade. Right now, he's being held on $750,000 bail. But I would not be surprised to see that charge reduced. I would not be surprised to see Mr. Chaminara not spend a whole lot of time behind bars this time around either, unfortunately. But he is our second deal of the day. And our good guy of the day. Actually, before we get to our good guy, let's go back and give you our second hero of the day, sponsored by AdCor Defense. Minot, North Dakota. It was just before 7 p.m. Wednesday. 29-year-old woman there in Minot said she had stepped outside of her home deal with a dog when she was hit in the face with a blunt object that knocked her down the stairs back inside her home. The suspect who had hit her in the face then ran in after her. But according to Minot police, the victim managed to get a firearm from a gun cabinet and aimed it at the suspect. And that's when he turned around and took off running. The woman said that she could only identify the intruder to be a male. Police said she did not need medical attention. The case is under investigation, but thankfully she is okay. One wonders if this story might have had a different outcome had she not been able to get to that firearm. But that unidentified 29-year-old woman, again, today's second hero of the day. And you know what? Since we're doing multiples here, we've got a couple of good guys to talk about as well. Why not? It's Friday. We want to leave you with a plethora of stories here as we head into the weekend. First, from Clarksville, Tennessee, Actually, Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which straddles the border there between Kentucky and Tennessee. Clarksville Now is the website reporting on the story of a sergeant there at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, who came to the aid of local law enforcement. Sergeant Jameel Moore. It was back on February the 28th, around 11:15 at night. Sergeant Moore came into contact with a individual walking in his neighborhood. He observed the individual, noticed him walking from car to car, trying to open doors. So Sergeant Jameel Moore called 911. While he was waiting for officers to arrive, he saw the man get a car door open, and then he called 911 again and said, okay, the guy's actually breaking in now. When police arrived, they were able to locate the suspect behind an apartment building, thanks to the eagle eyes of Jameel Moore. Made contact with the suspect. They discovered various items of property behind the apartment buildings, which were identified as items stolen from several vehicles in the neighborhood. Clarksville Now says the information that Sergeant Moore provided was also used in the interview with the suspect, which led to a confession by the suspect. Sergeant Moore went even further, the paper says, by voluntarily responding to the police department during late hours to complete a detailed statement. And without hesitation, sacrificed even more of his time by coming to court as a witness. So today, Sergeant Jameel Moore, recognized by the Clarksville Police Department for his actions, District 1 Commander Captain David Crockerell presented him with a citizen commendation certificate and a Clarksville Police Department challenge coin. Officer Natalie Hall said, from the CPD, thank you, Sergeant Moore and Fort Campbell, for your continued assistance in keeping the Clarksville community safe. And, you know, it's interesting that the paper and the police department note that Sergeant Moore took the time to go to the police department to be interviewed by officers. He took the time to go to court to testify against the suspect. These are important things. Because if you don't have that as a prosecutor, if you don't have that eyewitness information as a police officer, you might not be able to make the arrest. You might not be able to get the prosecution. And unfortunately, you know, if you listen to this program on a regular basis, you know, we've had our deals of the day before where it's not the judge and it's not the prosecutor and it's not really, you can't even really say it's the system. It's witnesses, victims in some cases who don't show up, who refuse to testify. And someone with a lengthy criminal history able to plead down to almost nothing or even see their case dismissed. And they're back in court before long, but they were helped out by, again, that lack of eyewitness testimony. So to Sergeant Moore for being in the right place at the right time on a couple of different occasions and doing the right thing, we thank you, sir, for being one of the good guys of the day. And our second story, Mary Callison, from 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, shared this story with me on Twitter earlier today. You know, we've talked with Mary on the program before, and she's talked about her sister, who was the victim of a brutal attack not long ago. It was in Willowbrook, Illinois. And Mary's sister, Melissa Schuster, is speaking out about that attack. It's a story in the Chicago Tribune by Vicki Ortiz Healy. It's a very difficult story to read, I'll be honest with you. But the courage of Melissa Schuster in speaking up and in speaking out and in letting other victims know you don't have to be afraid and you certainly should not be ashamed. This is a very important thing that Melissa has done. In fact, that's what she said to the Chicago Tribune. She said, quote, I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to be ashamed of. She says she's now determined to share her hard-earned lessons with as many people as possible that other victims of sexual violence may feel less alone. She said, my whole life was completely uprooted and turned around. And as horrible as it was, I want to use it to encourage others. And she is. Melissa Schuster is encouraging women to take self-defense courses to be able to defend themselves. She says that the attack against her lasted less than 15 minutes. She just pulled into the driveway of her parents' home. That's where she lived at the time. A car pulled in behind her. Guy got out. He demanded money. Wanted to use the phone. He then forced his way into the home. He stabbed her 17 times before sexually assaulting her. And he left her in the kitchen for a minute, laying there bleeding on the kitchen floor. And Melissa, she said, it was almost like somebody carried me out of that house. She said, I remember looking down the street and slamming the door open. 31-year-old Lawndale Madison has been charged with attempted murder, aggravated sexual assault, home invasion robbery, armed robbery. He has not yet faced a trial. He is currently in the DuPage County Jail on $5 million bail. And it was the day after the attack, the Chicago Tribune says, that Melissa Schuster surprised even her family members when she agreed to appear before TV cameras and other media outlets where she was treated. Since then, the paper says she has told her story to two self-defense classes. She posts regular photos of her healing face on Facebook. Mary Callison, with 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, her older sister, quoted in the story as well. She said, she is so strong. It's unbelievable. It didn't change her. It didn't make her withdrawn from people. As I said, this is a lengthy article. Can't share it all with you. But if you have the opportunity, Cameron, I'll send you the link here in a second. And we'll tweet it out at Cam and Company. Melissa Schuster there in Illinois, speaking up, taking a stand, and definitely one of the good guys out there. Now, we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on Baltimore's WBAL, on the gun control state senator there in Maryland, who says that they will not stop pushing anti-gun laws until they get the death toll down to zero, while the numbers are headed the opposite direction there in Baltimore, Maryland. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball. I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Well, we are here at the AdCorps booth at SHOT Show 2016. AdCorps, of course, our on-location sponsor for 2016. And our friend Clint Romachet, you're hanging out of the booth all week long, right?
Yeah, back here with AdCorps once again for another great SHOT Show, showing off some of the rifles again and just, you know, linking back up with old friends and old people that it's good to be with.
You know, it's good that we have a chance to hang out and spend at least a couple of minutes together here. I got to tell you, I've been shooting the heck out of my AdCorps rifle, and, you know, I can say it's everything that you said it would be, Clint, honestly. I mean, it is rugged, it is dependable, and it is accurate as all get out, man. I mean, really.
I mean, yeah, having you at the range day and you know, finally getting a rifle into your hands, I mean, it's just, you know, you can say you can build something that's going to be accurate and reliable, but everyone can say whatever they want. It's when you come to prove it, and actions always speak louder than words, and that's what AdCorps has done time and time again.
So kind of walk us through. We've got an AdCorps right here, right? This is the Elite A556, right?
Yep. It's our 556, 223, whatever you want it, really. Because of our gas piston system, we can go suppressed, unsuppressed, or if you're firing, like I said, 556 or Remington 223, everything's toolless, one button. I can push out, dial my gas in right there so I don't have to break my rifle apart. But it's designed to be very simplistic, except the thing that's always attracted me is the forward charging handle, non-reciprocating ambidextrous that allows you to stay on target and trigger in case you have something go wrong. But the great thing about it is just that quick. If we got a lefty that's coming in to shoot right there, and he can, you know, have the same benefits of having that forward charging handle ready to go.
Again, no time-lapse photography here. I mean, it really is just that easy. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Tony Katz coming up from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. But right now, I want to welcome from WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland, host of the Derek Hunter Show, Mr. Derek Hunter. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, Cam. Yeah, it's a good thing I got that job because they had the name picked out before they hired me.
Right? Imagine that would have been really awkward if the Derek Hunter Show was hosted by, you know, Bobby Z or something like that. That would be really strange. Yeah, but it's a good fit. You fit in well there with the Derek Hunter Show.
It was like I was born to do it.
Right? Exactly. And I'm guessing that hosting a show in Baltimore, Maryland has got to be really, really interesting, especially on conservative talk radio, because Maryland, you know, Baltimore is not exactly a conservative city, Derek, or at least it doesn't really have that reputation.
Well, it's not. It only has that reputation because it's been ruled by Democrats for about 55 years. So, yeah, it's justified. But the state, surprisingly, it's 50,000 watts, and we elected a Republican governor last time.
So, well,
with a 2-to-1 registration against us, we managed to elect a Republican.
That's
so
the thing.
It's possible. Every once in a while, they sober up or stay home, whatever it was.
And, you know, and there are a lot of gun owners across the state of Maryland, legal gun owners across the state of Maryland. And some of them were up in Annapolis yesterday. It was a gun day at the state legislature. And you had a state senator there in Maryland. I just thought this was fascinating. Jamie Raskin from Montgomery County, a D.C. suburb, said that he and his fellow lawmakers will not quit pushing gun control until they have a annual death toll of zero. He said, we're going to stop when we get to a death toll of zero in the state of Maryland. That's when we're going to stop. You know, Derek, it seems to me like that might, you're going to keep going, because right now the numbers are going in the wrong direction. You know, they passed the Maryland Firearm Safety Act a few years ago, and then Baltimore's homicides have exploded ever since.
Well, I don't understand that. They passed those strict laws you talked about, and the death toll went up. It's almost as though these criminals are ignoring the law, Cam. And we really need to launch an educational program targeted towards criminals so that they can understand that they should not be breaking the law, because clearly somebody forgot to tell them in their childhood. No, it's very rare that a politician tells you what their ultimate goal is. Jamie Raskin's ultimate goal is to get rid of all guns in the state of Maryland, at least legal guns. The illegal guns, there's nothing they're proposing that will do a damn thing about that, and those just happen to be the ones used in 99% of the murders. But, it's the reason Jamie Raskin is pushing this, and the reason you get ridiculous rhetoric like that from Jamie Raskin is he is trying to replace Chris Van Hollen, in the U.S. House of Representatives. And he's facing a tough primary right now against Kathleen Matthews, the wife of Charlie Brown's illegitimate child, Chris Matthews. So he's got a pretty big pile of money coming at him.
Okay.
Name recognition and favorability. So he's got to try and overcome that somehow. So he's going to try and out-liberal her.
Huh. So, you know, that... Okay, it starts to make a little bit more sense because we certainly have seen this big push from the Bloomberg-backed anti-gun groups, you know, telling lawmakers around the country, it's okay to tout gun control. It's okay to go after the NRA. Don't be afraid. We'll give you money. I think it's sort of that unspoken, you know, bargain here, right? If you start speaking up, if you catch our eye, well, look, you know, Bloomberg's got some pretty deep pockets. And by the way, Derek, he's not running for president now, so he doesn't have to, you know, there's $1 billion freed up to spend on other people who are running for office. Yeah, I guess I can see why an anti-gun lawmaker hoping to make a splash and hoping to get maybe some donations there would try to use that as an issue. Although it should be noted that, you know, like Martin O'Malley ran for president briefly. And he wanted to be the gun control candidate. He was talking up what he did in Maryland. He was talking up the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. It didn't seem like that really helped him a whole lot across the country.
Well, the problem with Martin O'Malley's campaign is he talked a good game, but then people actually remembered the results of what he did. That was his biggest drawback. And that and being the model for the Tommy Carchetti character in The Wire. And they had to tone it down, the Carchetti character, to tone down the arrogance. To make it believable for TV. Yeah, Martin O'Malley was his own worst enemy. He's the only guy who plays guitar while flexing in short sleeve shirts. But no, Bloomberg, you're right. They want the Bloomberg money, and Bloomberg has a special place in his heart for Maryland because he went to Hopkins. Johns Hopkins is now a walking campus because Bloomberg donated some ungodly sum of money that you and I could only dream of.
It's the home of the Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Right. He turned the campus, which used to be a normal college campus. It had sidewalks and roads. They turned all the roads into walkways. So now it's a walking campus because he's been an obnoxious, I'm going to tell you how to live billionaire for a very long time. So he's got a special place in his heart for Maryland. So making yourself into an anti-gun nut in Maryland is a good way to get his attention. The problem is, he's running against Christine Matthews, or Kathleen Matthews. God, it would be awful if she was Christine and he was Chris. He's running against Kathleen. It would be very narcissistic to call it his own name. He's running against Kathleen Matthews, and then there's another guy named David Trone, who's a fairly wealthy businessman, who's just as liberal. So that it is really difficult to differentiate yourself on the gun issue when all of your opponents are pretty much looking for complete prohibition.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's probably not, this is, I'm guessing, a deeply a blue district here.
The People's Republic of Montgomery County. It is right butt up against Washington, D.C. A lot of media types live there. A lot of government bureaucrats live there. Very moneyed, especially along the border with D.C., and very, very, very left-wing. They've elected Chris Van Hollen voluntarily since 2002.
And as you say now, Chris Van Hollen, he's going to be running for Senate, right?
He's running against Donna Edwards. That's kind of fun to watch, too, because the latest poll had it 42 Van Hollen, 41 Edwards. And they're both vacating their House seats to run for this, so that's nice. We've got that going for us. But it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in that race, and I expect gun control will be a major part of that race as well.
I suspect that you are correct. I've got to ask you, we've got you here about the Maryland or the Baltimore mayor's race, because I think everybody in Baltimore is officially a candidate now, right?
Yeah, they really, when D. Ray McKesson threw his hat in the ring, that was the last straw. That completed the clown car of something like 17 or 37. I can't even keep track of it anymore. Very inexpensive and easy to fill out the forms and write the check to get on the ballot. So it's not a high bar for entry, but yeah, it's going to be interesting.
And did I see correct that there's a poll that came out? And I realize, you know, mayoral poll is probably even more difficult to poll than the presidential polls, but did DeRay McKesson get 1% in a recent poll there?
Yeah, which technically means you, Cam, are tied with D-Ray. With, when you factor in the margin of error, you are tied in the polls right now with D-Ray McKesson for the next mayoralty of Baltimore. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's quite an honor. I thought that was really, really interesting because, to me, that indicates that, again, the name recognition, the applause of the pundits and the chattering class, really, across the political spectrum this year, Derek, it really doesn't seem to matter much to voters, right? I mean, you could be the darling.
Except for Donald Trump.
Well, even then, I think, there's, I don't think Donald Trump has gotten a lot of the applause of the chattering class. He's gotten a lot of attention. But, you can be the critical favorite. You can get all kinds of a glowing press. Doesn't necessarily translate into voters even knowing who you are in a lot of cases.
Well, you got to realize he's got, somewhere in the neighborhood of 330,000 Twitter followers, which is good. Who wouldn't want that many
sure.
Twitter followers? But it's a city of 600,000 and a nation of 330 million. So those Twitter followers are worldwide. Most of them are in media, and most people, as you know, don't watch their local news or the national news. So his name recognition amongst people who care about such things is very high, but amongst people who are living in the city of Baltimore who really are concerned and, it's getting dark out, I have to get home because I can't be out on my own street.
Mm-hmm.
Those people don't really worry and care what some guy who's a professional protester thinks 140 characters at a time. So it's one thing to get name recognition. He got a splash when he jumped into the race. But in general, people want to know where the beef is. And the people who are polling high in that poll, the Gonzalez poll, are a state senator, a former mayor. Now, granted, she had to resign in disgrace after stealing some gift cards earmarked for kids.
Why let a little thing like that stand in your way of your political
career? She's apologized. Who hasn't committed just a little bit of larceny in this time?
Come on.
Especially in politics. I mean, there's much worse she could have stolen.
She taught them a valuable lesson.
Yeah.
And
everybody else who polls well is a current politician that has been doing something good or bad on balance. That's up to the individual, but at least they have a record. It is not celebrity. And I give credit to the people of Baltimore for at least saying we aren't going to go with the flashy name that the media would love for us to do.
Absolutely. All right. Before we run out of time, one last question for you. How are things in Baltimore now? Towards the end of last year, we obviously saw a lot of stories about the sky-high homicide rate. And then after the first of the year, the national media kind of quit paying attention to Baltimore.
Things are okay. They're better than last year. Not that there was anywhere to go but up. We had a tragedy here where some evil SOB murdered two police officers about a month ago in Harford County. But as far as the city goes, murders are down. Thus far, although it didn't really kick up last year until really, really kick up until about May.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see about that. But people are getting sick of it. I think the police are starting to do their jobs again. The Ferguson flu seems to have gone away. The trials are moving forward. The city sort of calmed down. It's much better than Chicago. I saw a stat the other day, 500 shootings in Chicago already. 500.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, more than
that's not murders, but I mean shootings. That's insanity at this point in the year. But you don't hear about that in the media either. But thankfully Baltimore, things are ticking down. And again, with only 600,000 people and 344 murders last year, more than since 1974, there was nowhere to go but up in that.
Talking again with Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore. Derek, we unfortunately have got to run, but thank you, sir, for coming on the program today, and enjoy your weekend.
Always a pleasure. You too, Cam. Have a good one.
All right, we'll talk soon. Derek Hunter with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indiana, will join us after a quick timeout, so stick around. We'll be back with much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Romanelli with the NSSF Project Child Safe. Bill, welcome to NRA News.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for being here. And what a great program, the Project Child Safe program. I absolutely love it. Tell folks, what is it?
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is the firearms industry's safety program. It was launched in 1999 as Project Home Safe initially, and then it evolved into Project Child Safe. And it really operates along two central fronts. One is it's all about firearm safety education, primarily focusing on responsible storage of firearms when they're not in use. And then hand-in-hand with that, the other facet of this, and kind of the centerpiece of the program, is we give away free gun locks to police departments all across the country to hand out in their communities. And so far, we've given away 37 million of those locks.
37 million.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenally successful program, and it is something that the firearms community can be very proud of.
Wow, that's amazing. So tell, how did this program get started and why?
Well, primarily it got started because it was an opportunity for the industry to step up and say, you know, we don't want to see firearms accidents happen. There's, you know, even today, unfortunately, too many stories of children finding loaded guns in the home and an accident resulting from that. And so this industry stepped up, and there's a brainstorm of somebody at NSSF to come up with this program to basically let's teach people what they need to know about proper firearm safety and expel some of the myths, like, you know, a hidden gun is not a safe gun, for example. And at the same time, let's take away some of the barriers to safe storage by making these locks available for free.
And Bill, you're with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. People don't know that the NSSF is the industry, the shooting industries association.
That's a trade association.
Yeah, trade association.
Industry, huh?
So the you have done this, you know, working in concert with the, you know, all the different gun manufacturers. But NSSF has really taken a leadership role as this program has grown. Tell us, over the years, how has it grown and changed?
Sure. Well, we were very, very big program in the 2000s. We were getting a lot of federal funding through the Department of Justice to do the program. And that's where we had a lot of our biggest successes and where we, you know, we're giving away most of the locks. Then in 2008, the grant terms expired and they weren't renewed. And so the NSSF on its own continued to fund the program for the next several years. And I am happy to say that for 2016, some of that federal funding has now been renewed.
Oh, good.
To the tune of about $2 million, which, you know, as we say, every $2 puts another lock in someone's hands. And so that will provide a lot of money for both making more locks available in communities as well as getting more educational resources out there.
And Bill, one of the things we all talk about is, as you mentioned, is safety is paramount. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're at home, you're on the range, that's like, you know, the first order of business when it comes to, you know, the firearm, you know, using a firearm, whether you're hunting or shooting or at the range or whatever. So in some of the time we left, you know, what are some of the most egregious kind of safety violations you guys are aware of?
Well, you know, it's the funny thing. It's like when you look at the rules of firearm safety, number one, they're not rocket science. And number two, they really haven't changed since the firearm was invented. It's pointed in a safe direction, you know, keep it stored safely, things like that. And my personal opinion is I think that's why we have some of the accidents we do, is because the rules have been out there so long and they're so simple that we get a little bit complacent.
Yeah, and maybe take them for granted, right?
Exactly.
Which, when it comes to a firearm, you never want to take it for granted. So
that's right.
It's Bill Romanelli. It's the NSSF Project Child Safe. I love it. Bill, how can people get more information about Project Child Safe, about the National Shooting Sports Foundation? What do they need to do?
Sure. The easiest thing, of course, is going to go onto our website, which is www.projectchildsafe.org. We really would love people to, as individuals, sign up as supporters of the program. Also for organizations out there, retailers, shooting ranges, people in the conservation community. You know, we want as much help as we can get getting this word out. We don't rely on ourselves alone. We want to basically have essentially a team of messengers out there helping us get this message out there to the firearms-owning community. And if I may, you know, it's something that I've noticed is that the firearms-owning community, the firearm community as a whole, you know, they're a very proud community. You know, they do not like being villainized or demonized.
Right.
And, you know, they in fact focus on ethical hunting. They focus on responsible gun ownership. They're looking for something to be for and something that they can rally around. And this is a program that they can do that with.
That's awesome. All right, Bill, we got about 20, 30 seconds left. Once again, how can we get more information about Project Child Safe?
Sure. Go to www.projectchildsafe.org. If you're looking for safety resources, just click on our safety tab. Cool. Our entire library of safety resources is available there.
Beautiful. Bill Romanelli, the NSSF Project Child Safe, thanks for what you do. Thanks for the National Shooting Sports Foundation for what they do. And thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back. Thank you again for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Our friend Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, is with us. How are you, sir?
I am glorious. It's a beautiful day in Indianapolis. The sun is shining, and all is right with the world.
Fantastic. So you avoided the CPAC plague then? You
oh,
were fine?
Yeah. Oh, I have a strict regimen of getting sleep, drinking plenty of water, and not doing meth. And that seems to keep me healthy.
Really? Good for you. Good for you. That's the secret, huh? I don't know how that worked for me.
Well, I got to admit, of those three things, I mean, it's really important to drink plenty of water.
It is. Maybe that was the thing. Because I got plenty of sleep. I didn't do any meth, but I was drinking a lot of soda and not water. So maybe that was it.
See, that's a rookie mistake. That's a rookie mistake from a rookie guy. Don't be a rookie guy. That's all I'm saying.
How was your CPAC?
How was my CPAC? I think it was all right. I didn't get yelled at by anybody for not being a Trump supporter. I didn't get yelled at by anybody for being a Trump supporter. I did get questioned a lot about whether or not I'm a Trump supporter. It seems that whether or not you're a conservative, whether or not you're a decent human being, whether or not you should be stoned to death is all based on whether or not you're a Trump supporter, depending on whether or not you're talking to a Trump supporter.
Yeah, there was a it was interesting because I going into CPAC, I really wasn't sure what to expect. I knew that, you know, certainly you watch on social media, passions are running high among supporters of each individual candidate. I wasn't sure how this would play out with thousands of activists in such close proximity to one another. But I think everybody got along pretty well.
Yeah, you know, it's something that we did discuss, a whole bunch of us, that there wasn't the campaigning that has taken place at other CPACs. I didn't see a lot of signs. I didn't see a lot of stickers or T-shirts for this candidate or that candidate.
Right.
But certainly I saw some of those Never Trump ribbons and the hashtag Never Trump stuff. And Trump was certainly a fundamental conversation. The other one was, what happens next? Is the Republican Party willing to lose rather than win with Trump? Are they really that afraid of Ted Cruz? What happens to the party either way, the Republican Party, it's not conservative so much, on November 9th, the day after Election Day? What are they? What do they become? What will they be like? So those are the questions, and I think some of them are good, worthy questions, and I haven't met too many people who are bothered by blowing it all up and starting fresh. Maybe the Republican Party needs exactly that.
You know, it's interesting. We started off the show with Ed Morrissey of Hot Air, and I asked him a similar question about the party and then the conservative movement, because these are two different things. The Republican Party and the conservative movement are often aligned. They are often comprised of the same individuals, but they are two separate entities. And, you know, you talk about what's going on with the GOP. What do you think is going to happen to the conservative movement on November the 9th? What do you think is happening right now, Tony? Is this are you concerned? Is this a good thing? Is this something that, you know, just periodically happens in American politics and we have this sort of a realignment? Or is this, everything that we know crumbling around us?
Well, no, I don't think it's everything we know crumbling around us. First of all, the movement remains the movement. Conservatism remains, exists. It's real. It's important. It's valuable. It has something to offer, something to share, something to provide. And I think anybody who thinks at any moment in their life clearly accepts the fact that at some level they're a conservative. The question is, are you willing to give it up to win? Are you willing to give up conservatism for the idea that you can get a victory and get the two or three things you've been promised but have never received? Now, those people are right. We've talked about immigration. We haven't gotten the quote-unquote reforms that we needed. We've talked about walls, but walls haven't been built. We've talked about the issue of radical Islamic terrorists, the proliferation of radical Islamic terrorists, and nobody seems to be willing to do any of the hard work about that, and don't speak in strong tones. You take those three subjects and you realize why Trump is popular. But that's a different thing than whether or not conservatism lives or dies. Conservatism lives. What we've learned is that some people aren't actually conservatives. They have some subjects that happen to align with conservatives.
Well, that's a whole different group of people. And they're going to have to become something else, or maybe that's what they turn the Republican Party into. But conservatives remain conservatives because principles are principles, values are values, standards are standards. Those things don't change. The idea of individual liberty, the idea of letting people live their lives the way they want to live their lives, the idea of just leaving people alone for the love of all things good, decent, and holy. In Tampa, Florida, Hillsborough County, Florida, they ticket Uber drivers because the state has not yet regulated Uber and Lyft. Translation, because the state hasn't decided how much money to take from you, we give you tickets until the state determines what kind of business you are and whether you're allowed to be in that business. That's not a conservative principle. That's crap. And as long as that crap exists, the conservative movement will clearly exist to fight that insanity. So I feel good about conservatism and where it's going. I would feel better if we worked harder on its messaging and on ways of explaining these things. I think the Uber conversation is a great one, by the way. But more importantly, it stays. It exists. It's the Republican Party that I don't know its future.
Talking again with Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News. I don't know if you saw this. Over the Weekly Standard, there was an interesting piece this week. Christian Lowe wondering, did guns doom Hillary in Michigan? You know, she's been out there bashing Bernie Sanders for being slightly not so awful on guns. Still pretty awful, it has to be said. But you know, during the debate in Michigan before the primary, Bernie Sanders said, you know, listen, when it comes to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, it sounds to me like what you want to do, Hillary, is you want to just end gun manufacturing in this country. The NRA highlighted Sanders' comment. A lot of people were wondering, all right, why is the NRA pointing this out? Christian Lowe writes at the Weekly Standard that if you look at the vote in Michigan, he said Clinton had the urban voters locked up. Sanders crushed Clinton in rural areas in the southeast, southwest, and the hunter-heavy north, central, and upper peninsula, where he beat the former New York senator by 20 points. Christian Lowe says, sure, the media leader probably right that the white union families drove a lot of momentum towards Bernie Sanders' surprise win, but it's guns that might have put him over the top. I'm curious what you think about this, because we've also seen this in a couple of other states, including Iowa, where Hillary Clinton was widely expected to compete. She ran a ton of gun control commercials in New Hampshire. About one in four of her commercials in New Hampshire were promoting her gun control positions. And it doesn't seem to be helping her in the Democratic primary, Tony.
If we're cherry picking states of New Hampshire and Michigan, maybe not. I don't know. Listen, the only person who I could say to Hillary that guns have, you know, absolutely doomed was Ambassador Christie. Everything else, I think, is sometimes just a question of politics, especially when we talk about New Hampshire and Michigan. Maybe that has something to do with it. I would think that if you were, though, a Democrat who was big into the Second Amendment, or at least had a belief in the Second Amendment, you also wouldn't go to Bernie Sanders, because somewhere in the back of your head you know that that guy is going to confiscate anything he dang well pleases if he's president of the United States, or at least that's his vision, and that was the vision of his elders and those who taught him to be the kind of savage that he is. So I'm not sure. I think it's an interesting take. I think that's something that should be explored. I think it's something that should be written about, maybe put into the public consciousness. And that Hillary's position on guns, that Hillary's hatred of gun owners, is really doing her harm in this election. And then she'll say, yeah, but super delegates, ha ha ha, and take the nomination.
Well, this is, you know, look, this is something else I think that is worth talking about, because the media loves to talk about what's going on in the GOP, but we also are seeing, I think, a splintering on the left as well here. By the way, are you in a wind tunnel somewhere? Are you in a convertible? Where are you?
No. I was enjoying the fresh air on the Freedom Deck.
Do I need to
move for you? Is it causing a disturbance?
You're okay. It just sounds like you're, you know, breathing extra heavy at times, but that's just the wind, I think.
I had a vision of John Poppin, you know.
that Midwestern wind.
I saw him at CPAC, and he was just, you know, glistening there in the CPAC stale air, and I was just like, that's what men should look like. And all the ladies were like, oh, John Top, can we love you? Can we hold you? And, it, you know, it's, that's a good life.
It's good to be the king. So, real quick, we've only got about 2 minutes left here, but, you know, is the media, I'm curious, do you think the media is intentionally downplaying the divide on the left because it's much more fun, entertaining, opportune to cover the fractures and the splits on the right?
Well, I don't think that the divide on the left is as great as you say as it is. If you want to talk about the loss of enjoyment on the left, that in its totality, sure. But divide, I think that's a little too much in the weeds for what NBC Nightly News is going to do, especially when you could talk about Trump and Rubio and penis size.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been sort of an awful media cycle, I have to say. We talk a lot about the media bias, but it's been fascinating to me to see just, you know, what the important stories of the media are every day. So there was a story, Ashley Banfield of CNN was complaining about her son using the word loser now, and she was like, well, you know, this is he watches a lot of political TV, and he's picking this up, and I feel like a bad parent. And I thought to myself, so there's no reflection on the stories and the you know, what's leading the news cycle there on CNN or other cable news channels, right? No reflection there. It's all just it's just these horrible messages that these are suddenly appearing on our TV sets.
Well, if the horrible messages have all come from the Republican debate and no one ever blames MTV for anything, Then clearly we only learned one important thing. More people are interested in what Republicans are doing than catfishing. And I think that's worthwhile. That's a win for America.
There you go, buddy. Well, listen, you enjoy the Freedom Deck. You have any minor league hockey games or WNBA games or donut judging contests, anything going on this weekend?
Donut Day Indy is June 3rd. We've got the Big Ten Championship going on in Indy this weekend. IU just lost, so who really cares about the whole thing anyway? I'm going to take it easy, put my feet up, and have some fun.
Well, enjoy yourself. We appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
All right, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz and the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Tony talked about the Big Ten championships underway. The NCAA rifle championships are also underway, and as a matter of fact, West Virginia freshman, make sure I get the name correct here. West Virginia freshman Jenny Thrasher is the 2016 NCAA small bore rifle champion. How about that? Congratulations to Jenny Thrasher. I think Jenny Simone is probably a little happy about that as well. Hope she has a great weekend. Both Jennies, actually. Hope you do, too. And hope we get to see you here on another edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRAnews.com, midnight Eastern, SiriusXM Patriot, on demand all the time, iTunes, iHeartRadio. We'll see you soon.